Hey, kids.
You're listening to the internet's wettest podcast about video games, consoles,
and pancakes.
The SML Podcast.
What's up, everybody? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe. Joining as usual, we've got Aki here at the start of the show. Aki, how are you doing?
Pretty good. It's pretty early for sleepy me, but otherwise great.
Hey, it's early for a reason. And it's a good one.
What's that?
It's because we have an interview. Yay!
Are you sure? I don't think we do.
But we do. I was going to say his name, and then you were like, Andrew Smith of Spilt Milk Studios, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Hello. I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having me. I should warn you, I have a bit of a head cold, but hopefully it doesn't come across too poorly on the audio. But yeah, I'm good. How are you guys?
I'm doing pretty good. Jumping off of you, I got a pretty big headache myself. Her name's Aki. She's my co-host. had to do that. For the people who don't know what Trash Goblin is and who Spilt Milk Studios are, give us the sales pitch on the game and tell us who you are.
Alrighty, well, Spilt Milk Studios, we're a small independent studio based mostly in the UK, although we do have one lovely artist over just outside Chicago. We've been going for 16 years, which is terrifying. Our wow. Anniversary was like literally last week, so that's a whole
Congrats.
Thing. Thank you. We spent a good 10 years of our studio life just sort of being the traditional indie, jumping from, you know, interesting thing to cool thing to whatever. And then, I guess 6 years ago, we kind of thought, let's plan out the next 10 more sensibly. And that's kind of where Trash Goblin comes in. It's the first released, although not the first thing we worked on, in this kind of fantasy world that we've built. As a studio, we have sort of rallied around the flag of kind of cozy games, wholesome games, made with a little bit of a twist. We self-publish, so we're all about pleasing the players. You know, we don't have shareholders, we don't have a publisher who we're trying to, you know, make happy. It's all about the players for us and the community. So that's the studio. And then, yeah, Trash Goblin. Well, it's, you know, it's spoilers. It's cozy. It's wholesome. But you play a little goblin running a shop in a fantasy city. They're called a trinketeer, the job that they've got. So basically, they take bags of trash that are delivered, and they chip away at all of the dirt and the rubbish on them to kind of expose whatever trinket is inside. It could be, you know, a bent nail. It could be something really valuable. And then you can clean it up. You can upcycle these things together into all kinds of wonderful things. And then you sell them. And there's, you know, random customers. You can kind of lay out your wares to attract different, you know, different customers and that sort of thing. There's a reputation system, but also there's a sort of a story, a quest line to play through, which is probably at this point like maybe more than 10 hours long, I would say, because we're at like 1.4 now. It's a game that's very dear to our hearts, and people have really fallen in love with the characters, and it was a heck of a journey getting it to release, but we're here, it's out on consoles, and we're super happy.
I have put a few hours into the game myself, and I'm actually mad that I'm doing this interview because I want to be playing the game right now. I have so much fun just chipping away at things.
I'm so glad to hear that.
I can't explain, like, it's like popping bubbles in bubble wrap. It just feels good to click things away, and then, boom, I have a friggin' hand.
I just got a hand recently in my own game.
I have two different hands. Why are there different hands?
One's like, so you can build a robot later or something.
Yeah, who knows, right? Who knows why people throw these things away and why they turn up? But yeah, it's fun. It's fun seeing people's expressions when they get things, some of the more like interesting or like unexpected things, like the hands. Yeah, that's good.
I actually have a quick question, potential bug report. One of the doll legs, I think it was, it's not the toad, it was the, what's the other dolls in the game?
There's like a witchy doll, there's a mushroom doll, there's a few dolls now actually, there's quite a lot. It's like a whole set.
I think it was
I've only found the mushroom one.
Is it a dragon doll?
There might be,
The one foot, I kept cleaning it, it would max out at 65%.
Oh, no.
Toes?
Yes.
Did you clip its nails? That's the
I
other thing.
I did not clip the nail. What tool is that in the game?
Sadly, that is, no, that's, you know, something we might add as a DLC later, I guess. Yeah, pedicure, exactly, right, exactly. That sounds like a familiar bug. As in, we've had that on a couple of trinkets here and there. So, noted, I will go and check with the team, and we'll probably end up fixing it quite soon.
I will double check what the item is after
appreciated.
Matter of fact, but just to go with that, since Joe's already done it, I wasn't going to do this until later. But the beer stein, for some reason, the top can go on or the handle can go on. You can't put both on. Because they both for some reason.
Is that a limitation of the tool, though, Aki? Did you upgrade your recycler item?
No, I have not, I don't think.
There you go.
From what I could tell, and this is just through my own deduction, is that I got the recycler, and then I got an upgraded recycler, which allows me to attach two things instead of one. And then the dragon doll I was talking about earlier, I got to attach five friggin' things. So I'm guessing you get to upgrade those tools pretty high, yeah?
Yeah, you do. Yeah. And there's an upgrade to let you, I think quite early on in its tech tree, it allows you to kind of rotate things before you attach them as well. So you can kind of be a bit more creative with what you're doing. But yeah, you need to upgrade that upcycler tool and then you'll be able to attach more things at once.
It's weird. I've been able to attach multiple things at once this whole time.
Oh, if that's true, that's a bug. Absolutely. But it's worth having a little check.
Okay. That's good to know.
Aki breaks things a lot. So.
That's fine. It's
I just generally assume things are working fine.
So where did the beginnings of Trash Goblin start? When did the project first be an idea at the studio?
So it started about 4 years ago, and it's kind of a meeting of two things. So the first was, or not the first, but one part was, we do quite a lot of work with universities in the UK. So we often set, like a creative brief for a team of student developers to try and build a game around, and we give feedback over the course of their year or whatever. And one idea that I thought would fit the sort of skill set and the scope of the team, because obviously every time it's different, you know, different amount of coders or artists, whatever, was have you ever played Picross, or they're called Nonograms, I think, but the Picross games are what you have on like Nintendo system.
I adore them.
Right. Ah, they're so good, right? And for the longest time,
World series on Steam, I'm going to give them a shout out from Score Studios.
Okay, I'm going to really go add good. That. I'm going to go add that to my wish list, absolutely. I love those games.
Play and, too.
Oh, what? Oh, okay. Well, maybe I'm just going to get it. That's awesome. So I'd always thought that the kind of the meshing of that gameplay, especially in Picross, where you're like, you know, you're exposing like a, or you're revealing a picture of something or an object. I was like, what if it was an actual object? What if it was like archaeology? So the idea that you would just be chipping away at the dirt around an object, trying not to damage it. And then that was the game, right? That was the idea. So basically I was like, set this brief where make a sort of a maybe a 3D Picross, you know, because that's kind of fun. Tie it to archaeology, have a little sort of storyline, and go from there. And that team absolutely smashed it. And in fact, we ended up hiring two of the students who worked on that. And one of them is still with us as the artist, the main 3D artist on the project. So basically, very cool. All of the trinkets. Yeah, they've made, I would say, 90% of the trinkets, if not more, that you play with in the game is one artist who came from that student team, which is really awesome. So then on the other side, it was the timing around us exploring this fantasy world that we wanted to kind of create some games in. And I was kind of racking my brain around, like, the cozy games, the wholesome games, like chilled stuff, you know, low pressure gaming, and the idea of like the shopkeeper. And I always like, we always like to kind of have like a little twist to what we do. So it might be fantasy, but there's like a little bit of a twist. And I thought, well, what's the funniest twist? What's the kind of most eye-catching twist? It's like, well, you're playing as a goblin, right? At that time, there were not that many games where you would play as the goblin. And rather than it be like, oh, and therefore you're mean and angry or like scheming, it's you're just nice, you're a nice goblin, and goblins are nice. And so we kind of, these things kind of all came together at once. And when we were playing the sort of the student game, we could kind of see that fitting into this idea of running this kind of little trinket shop, right? The idea that you are kind of, you know, repairing or upcycling or combining stuff and turning trash into treasure, that came separately. But then when you kind of look at the whole Picross and the 3D element, putting them together from the archaeology game, it was like, oh, hang on, that's like the missing piece. So it just kind of, you know, it was kind of Choir of Angels and that sort of moment where you're like, wow, this just makes perfect sense.
So what, because we're talking about the Picross like part, what gave you the idea of giving you multiple different types of stuff to be breaking to get to this stuff? Because like the one that really does my head in is the purple stone where you can only hit it at one angle.
Yep.
Because yep. I get used to just hitting everything until it breaks, and then I hit that for a little bit, and I'm like, wait, no, this isn't the it's not doing anything. Oh, yeah, this is the one where I have to find wherever the thing is, and then I have to go search for that. And I'm like, what gave you that idea? Because I don't think I've ever seen that in another game.
Thank you. I mean, so it kind of touches on one of the biggest moments for the game where we made it very early on. We made it literally, it was 3D Picross for the chipping, right? So you'd have, you know, some kind of symbology or numbers that tell you, you know, which ones you can and can't break. And it was a puzzle, you know, literally a Picross puzzle. And we took it to a show and had real people play it outside of the team. And you just see people bouncing off of it. So the whole vibe of it, the name of it, the aesthetic, all of that attracted a certain kind of player. And then that player, not to paint with too broad a brush, but essentially they were like, yeah, they're not puzzle players. Yeah, they're not. They're like, why do I have to think? Why do I have to figure something out? I know what I want to do. I just want to get rid of the dirt and see the nice thing. So we're like, okay, well, what happens if we take that out? And you take it out and it becomes fairly mindless, right? Like you say, you can just sort of click, 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 and it's all kind of good. And then from there, we were like, okay, if we're not having like a traditional gameplay depth in the sense of like a puzzle game or like a skilled element, what can we do to keep it interesting over time to add enough variety that it, you know, keeps you kind of engaged? Because if it was too passive, if all you had to do was click, I think people would kind of zone out in a bad way. But with the little wrinkles, like you say, with some of the different block types, it just keeps it a little bit interesting, a little bit surprising. And you could just create, you know, something that when it presents, you know, you get the sack and you see this new lump of God knows what, you're like, okay, and your brain is tickled just enough. And it's not like your brain is like, oh God, I have to figure it out. It's just like, okay, let me tap here, see what happens. And that was basically where it all came from. So, I mean, your most hated block is one of my favorites, just because we definitely wanted something that made people need to handle the object, right? To spin it around in 3D space. We didn't want it to be something that was so static that you could just basically tap from without, you know, from one angle. We wanted to make sure you had to kind of like noodle around or like, you know, simulate that idea of like bring it up to your face and going, how do I get in here? How do I do that? So, yeah. It tickles me that you hate it, and I know you say it with
I like the purple intent. One, so
yeah.
I like following them like my snake-like path. Those are always fun.
Yeah,
I think my favorite is the light blue one, where a stiff breeze will destroy it and all of the other ones attached to it. There is one mechanic I really, really love about it. If you break all of them off that are attached to the actual item itself, but there's more out further, they just fall away. I really like that, because a lot of games, you'd still have to break those even though they're no longer attached to the object. So it's really nice that they just go the fuck away.
It's like the extra bubbles in Bubble Bobble. Bust a Move.
Bust a Move. Yeah, exactly. And it's, again, it's like, what's the word? It's like, you feel smart for doing it, right? Like, if you spot an opportunity for going, right, if I just chop through this little bit, and then all of that's going to fall away automatically, you feel great. And we're like, okay, that's the sort of, like, so we're going for, like, breadth and variety rather than, like, traditional depth. And that really, like, that defined for us like a real pillar across the whole game, and hopefully you guys can see that. Like the cleaning, it's not too taxing. The selling, there's no haggling, but you've got a reputation system to consider. You know, it was a real thing that really helped us go, okay, this is what the game is, but also what the game isn't. You know, and that's really important.
Have you considered when somebody is able to make a big chunk of blocks fall off at once, having a voice pop in of like cozy combo?
I mean, that speaks to my
like 15 pieces drop off at once, like cozy combo, snuggle yep. combo.
You're bringing back Killer Instinct in my brain here.
Damn right.
I love it. Absolutely. I think that'd be really funny. We did actually, when we were sort of brainstorming, we had the idea of doing like an a cappella version of every sound effect. So it's all like people's real voice noises. Just because we thought that'd be really, really funny. Lord knows if we'll ever be able to do it, but it'd be pretty good.
Other dumb noises going on.
Love it. Leaning into the ASMR crowd, you know, it's all of that good stuff.
That'd be amazing. It's like, what was it, the finger gun in Dead Space that just went pew, pew, pew when you shot
bang,
it?
Bang, bang, pew, pew, pew. I fucking love that thing. That's like one of my favorite weapons ever. It's made beautiful. For a game. That thing's so fucking great. Beautiful weapon.
So, Trash Goblin. Tell us about the characters in this game, because the Goblin is quite a unique character, and there's a whole cast of crazy characters in this game. Tell us about some of them.
Oh my gosh, where to begin? There's so many, right? So, I mean, for context, a lot of them came from our Kickstarter backers. So a lot of the really? Named characters are actually real people or their alter egos, right? Which is really cool. And it was really fun kind of like working out the team did all the work today. I'm going to be talking in the first person as if I did it, but like the team did an amazing job of like rolling those characters and their quirks and, you know, what trinkets they wanted to sort of their quest to revolve around into the story. But it was super important for us to be a really inclusive and sort of welcoming game. We didn't want to just rely on all the cliches. Obviously, you're a goblin, and that's a cliche, but we wanted our little, you know, our twist. You're a nice goblin. Goblins are nice. But we wanted to make sure that, you know, whilst obviously there were kind of humanoid characters, we wanted to explore what else we could do. And I think there was, like, a lot of it was drawn from, like, the Terry Pratchett side of fantasy, something that was just a bit more sort of left field and unexpected. Yeah, the sort of the core characters for me are you the goblin. Obviously, that's, you know, their personality is defined by, you know, I guess your internal monologue. You've got Eamon, and then you've got Auntie V, and those are really the kind of the found family, right, of the story. So Eamon is Well, they've got a bit of a criminal past. We don't go into it too much, and I won't spoil anything, but they've got a bit of a criminal past, and they're your guardian, your active guardian. So they're the person who's kind of helping you set up this new business, and they're looking after you, and they're making sure you've got your upgrades and you this, that, and the other. But also, they are a business person, so, you know, they charge you money. And then you've got Auntie Val, who, I mean, she has a fairly antagonistic relationship with Eamon. You know, they go way back. They've got history. Auntie Val's actually got history with your parents, who unfortunately are deceased in the story. So you're an orphan, but these two between them are your sort of your parents and guardians. And for me, they're the real heart of the story. But I know people really love Donoval the lizard. He has become a bit of an icon amongst the community. Mostly because
Jack, even though I've only met him once.
Oh, Jack's one of my favorites. That's great. Jack.
My favorite is the brand new customer I've never seen before.
Oh, Nomia.
Yeah.
Who is that? Who could it even be? It's a complete mystery. Who could say?
I fucking loved that.
I'll never figure it out. I don't know if there's like better hints later, but I'm clueless about that one.
Mystery for the ages.
Yeah,
you're just clueless about most things, Joe. So, you know, to be fair.
God damn right. Oh, love it. We have a Lady Magritte joining us. Bree, how are you doing?
I'm eating my breakfast. Time zones, am I right?
I know, right? I said the same thing.
For once, I was the first one prepared for things.
You were.
Messed up. Yeah. I don't like that.
I'm like, yeah, I even glanced at the Discord at like 10:57. I'm like, well, nothing's happening. I don't see Aki anywhere, so I... maybe I'm okay, and then 2 minutes later, where the fuck are you? Whoops.
Yeah, I apologize if I ask after anything that we've already discussed, because I got here late. My apologies if it's, you know, repetitive, but it sounds like you guys have had a good discussion so far.
Yeah, I hope so.
I think so.
I'm not taking blame for it. It is Joe's fault.
It is.
We got bug reports. We've chatted characters. We've chatted inspiration. We've covered all the bases. It's been great.
So what do you got, Bree?
Goodness. Cereal.
No, I've got oatmeal.
That was close.
I just took a bite too. Yeah. So yeah, you've created like a great entry into the chorecore genre. It's got like a good balance of cleaning sim and shop management, a little bit of like renovator style with the upcycling mixed in. I think the blend came out really good. I don't know if you're familiar with the chorecore phrase. It's one of my favorite.
It's so good. I've just now learned it. I'm like, I'm using this forever. This is amazing.
Yeah, chorecore is a great term for that. It even shows up on Google, so I'm not
crazy.
Does
it? Oh, yeah. Look at you. I'm proud of you, Bree.
Love it.
I didn't create the phrase.
You created it. That was entirely created by
I didn't hear
Joe says I've created. No. So yeah. But yeah. I was gonna say also that I love the title. I actually call my cat a trash goblin or an elegant trash goblin. This is obviously different. You already talked about some inspirations. You want to give me the quick highlights? I don't want to like go too into it, but I saw some stuff.
Yeah, the main thing was like when it used to be a Picross game, and then we took all the numbers and the puzzling out, and it became what it is today, basically.
Oh, okay. That is a cool thing to learn. I'll have to listen to the rest of the show when it goes live. I guess how long was production on this? Like, when did you guys start on this?
Oh, I people ask me dates and I feel old. I think the first work we did on it was probably 2022 or 2023. I think so. And it took a long time for us to figure out like exactly where it sat in the, you know, the chore core kind of pantheon. And then we ran a Kickstarter in late 2024, I think it was, which was, so we spent most of that year, I'm trying to work backwards. We're 2026 now, 2025. No, maybe it was 2023. Yeah. Anyway, so we spent most of that year, pitching it to publishers, the traditional indie route. And if anyone out there is interested, I did a big deep dive on Reddit about it that, went like semi-viral, back then. Cause we basically ended up pitching to 73 publishers.
Oh, wow.
We, Jesus. Yeah, it was basically got to the point where it was like everybody we could ever think of, you know, or find a contact for. We started out being like, these are the ones that we'd like to work with and who would, you know, probably like to publish it. And by the end of the year, we were desperate. But we got to like contracts with like two, or offers from two or three, and then contract with one, and then that fell apart. Unfortunately, the publisher, or the would-be publisher pulled out during the contract negotiation, and that led to us essentially going, well, if we don't do a Kickstarter, that's it, right? Like we fold. So, you know, that wasn't an option. So we did a Kickstarter and it went really well. And then, combined with a bit of work for hire, so I don't know if anyone's checked out Power Sim, like the first one. Yeah, we did the Wallace and Gromit DLC pack for that. We were kind of the main devs on the DLC pack. So there's like a nice crossover.
How you guys got that gig?
So it's a bit nepotism-y. So I know the founders of Future Lab. I've known them for probably 10 years. We've never worked together, but we get along quite well. And it's not like we were besties and going over for dinner every week. They live some distance away, but you know, very, very sort of good terms, and we respected each other's businesses. And in fact, I was on a podcast with one of them a very long time ago, just before COVID, funnily enough. Yeah, so like we kind of knew them and they knew us, and it basically the stars aligned. There was like we had some opportunity or some you know some time that we could spend, and they were looking for a team that they trusted. So it worked out well. But yeah, so that basically all combined to us being able to ship the game to early access, and then you know 1.0 was end of May last year, I think it was, which seems terrifying now. And then it's just come out on consoles, right? So. It's mad. It's quite exciting to think about how far we've come.
So tell me more about the Kickstarter experience. How was that for you? Like, what kind of, you know, options did you have for patrons? And tell me about that.
Well, one of the things I was saying just before you popped in was that one of the more exciting tiers of reward was that you could be a character in the game.
Oh.
One of the main customers, in fact, in the storyline. So we had a few areas. So basically, you could be like you know a named customer with a storyline and a trinket that goes alongside it that you get to you know help us design. But then you could also just be like part of the mix for the paper doll system that makes all the random customers, that sort of thing. So I think if you've seen, I think there's a character occasionally that will be holding like a red panda.
Okay.
Yeah, that's one of the people who was like, oh, I don't want to be like a named character, but I want like my likeness. So like sometimes you might luck out and see their whole likeness, but sometimes you'll just see like their hair or their, you know, their facial features, whatever, or their red panda. So yeah, we kind of ran the gamut, and it was all stuff that we wanted to do in the game, right? That was really important to us. It wasn't any physical outside of the game merch, so to speak, although we have done that since. It was all things that we want these people to be excited about the game, play the game, and then show their friends because they're in it, you know, or something they designed was in it. It went really, really well.
You have a new Kickstarter for merch. Yes.
We do. Yeah. Yeah, we ran it in February and it went really well. We have the most adorable goblin plush that you'll ever likely to see.
I've seen it. It is adorable. I put a link in the chat. For the new Kickstarter.
Fabulous, thank you.
Shit, yeah, there goes my money.
Yeah, it's pretty cute.
And again, I'm also the idiot over here, like looking at your original Kickstarter, doing the math on the Doppelgoblin tier, like it's still going, and I have a shot at it. No, I'm an idiot. It's over.
Wait for the next one. Wait for the next one. It's all good.
I get my cat in the game.
You've got a goblin plush. You've got a poster, some t-shirt,
an art book.
Yeah.
The art book's crazy. We've got some proofs actually printed out for the team. And there's something about it. Like, there's certain moments when you're making a game, and it's different now. Like, I'm 43, so I remember when you had to buy a game in a box, right? And you had a little instruction booklet, and you'd have, like, you know, that physicalization of a thing. I think it's important to some people, right? And I include myself there. But like, there's something about it that makes it feel more real in a way that is kind of like weird. It's a bit like the console releases. It's like, I finally downloaded it on the Switch and it felt more finished than it was, even though it's the same game. It's like, it's no different, dummy, you know, like it's on a console and that's how I play most of my games. So it felt more real, you know, it felt like a moment. But like, yeah, with the art book as well, like you hold this thing in your hand and you can read, you know, I wrote some of the words in there. It's not news to me, but like seeing it and holding it was like, oh wow, it means something different, you know?
So I see you have a cat named Lunatic, or Luna for short.
Yes.
You have any other... was Lunatic helpful in production of the game as well? Not just the photo shoot?
Just, you know, stress relief. You know, you're able to, like, you know, cuddle a cat when you're stressed. I think that's not to be underestimated. Lunatic actually is named that because they just followed my partner home one evening and moved in. And we're like, who does that? So it's like, you're clearly, you know, clearly a lunatic.
I was gonna say, we're big fans of cats around here and all that they do.
A little.
Just a little. Joe has a few cats.
I have just a few. A handful. Yeah.
A handful. I love it.
14.
Well, I won't spoil anything, but 14? Holy crap. That's impressive. That's not a handful. How big are your hands?
Gigantic. Our cats are very small.
Yeah, you're jack sized then. That's why you like Jack so much. That's impressive. So actually, one of the funniest things was one of the more interesting characters that you'll meet later on in the game is Mr. Pickles, who is the cat of someone who didn't want to be in the game themselves. They wanted their cat to be in the game as a customer, and we were like, I'm not sure how we can do that, but we'll try. So we figured out like an in-world reason for there to be a cat that can talk to you. It's quite a popular character, that one.
I totally would have done the same thing with our cat Peaches that we lost a couple years ago. We got her in the game Spilled as an alligator that you could find. And she's also a quest in the game Dreamed Away.
Oh, that's fabulous. I love that.
So I really wish I would have known about your Kickstarter.
One day I'll get Teak in a game. One day.
Oh, man, this new plush is really, really cute. Ashley's gonna kill me. So what are some of the cool trinkets you can find in this game?
Oh, man.
Dragon plushie?
Yeah, I'm trying to rack my brain because like I've been kind of like in the next project in my headspace, and I'm like, is there a dragon plushie that I didn't know about? There's every chance there is. It might also just be a really evil looking frog. I'm not sure. But
either way, I want it, and I'm not going to be selling it to anybody. It's just going to sit in my shop forever after I build it, because that's like my thing right there, especially if it's dragon. Oh my god.
I love that. So many people do that. We've got like a whole bit in our Discord where we're like, show us your shop. And so many people are like, this is my shop. I'm not selling any of this stuff. Please, can I like label things as not for sale?
And Yes, that would be great.
Yeah. That's definitely on our wish list. Like, we'd love to be able to do that as well. It'd be really cool. The trash, the trinkets, it's a weird mix, right? So you've got like wooden, like prosthetic fists, you've got like musical instruments from all the different like species in the games, like elves and dwarves and all kinds of frog folk, mushroom folk, the whole lot. And then you've got like really story specific ones that are, you know, to do with the characters, both ones that we've invented and from the Kickstarter backers, which is really interesting. But like, we had to have ones that are like naff or bad, right? Like, it can't feel like people are just throwing away all these incredibly valuable items, right? Or losing them, because it just doesn't, it sort of like reduces the impact. So we had to have like you know, a wooden like tankard or a, you know, a bent pipe, just to kind of give that bit of contrast. And those are probably some of my favorites. Like, you're like, why have I got half of a cog? And then you realize, oh, I can use it as like a handle on something, or, you know, make it a hat for something else. And that's like where it gets kind of interesting.
Aki, I have bad news for you. It wasn't a dragon plush. It's a goblin plush.
It's probably still going to be cute enough that I'm not going to sell it to nobody. That's fine. I'm probably going to get one of every plush finally fully put together, and I'm just going to keep them.
Love it. Love it. Share us a picture when you manage that.
Will do. I've been sitting on almost all of the limbs of the mushroom plush for a while now. I refuse to sell them, and I'm just like, where's the body? I need the body so I can put this shit together.
By the way, goblin plushy left leg is the one that gave me issues.
Ah, okay. We'll definitely check that one out. Yeah, the fun is when people start mixing and matching the plushies, like the different heads and the different bodies, and you can get some really, really good stuff. Yes,
I love it.
What's the craziest thing you've made in the game so far, Bree?
Not, I haven't been too crazy. I've been pretty conservative with my stuff. Like, you know, the lid goes on the tankard, and the handle goes on the candle holder. I don't know, or the hand. Yeah, the handle goes on the candle holder. I don't know. I've just kind of, I don't know.
You've been
way too conservative. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, like a rule following goblin, a non chaotic goblin. There's nothing wrong with that.
I mean, we're still early. We're still early. We have plenty of time to raise hell in the future.
we're working on something that I'm not going to say what it is, but we are going to be updating the game again before not too long, and we've got a new feature coming that's going to really kind of expand what you can do in terms of like the creativity of it. I'm not gonna say anything else than that, but I think that will really spark some imagination.
Speaking of the future, what is in the works? Is there other content besides what you've hinted at coming to the game? Can we see like weird cosmetic DLC or shop cosmetic DLC, anything like that?
So there's a bunch of stuff that's already out there. So like one of the weird things about the merchandise Kickstarter was that people started asking for the goblin plush to be a plush in the game. So it's like this like inception of plushes and goblins and things. But we did that, that was one of the rewards. And you can also just go and buy it because it's cute. But it doesn't matter. I'm the boss. It's fine. I can say what I like. So basically we do have, we just did 1.4 like a couple of weeks back, which was a bunch of new content with also like all the Asian languages localized as well. We are working on a 1.5. So you got to watch this space to see what's in there. And then we're also looking at a paid expansion. So we're testing the water, right? We're a small studio. This is our only game at the moment. So we've got to be quite careful about like how we, you know, like put our efforts, but we wanted to make sure we got like this really cool idea for like an expansion, and we wanted to make sure it was worth spending like a few dollars on, a few pounds on, whatever. And that's something that we'll be announcing more details about relatively soon, but it's quite exciting. And it really kind of takes some of the stuff that you're used to in the game in a slightly different direction. It's still very cute, very wholesome, very, very, you know, cozy and trash goblin. And there's a lot of returning characters and things, but it's kind of I don't know if it's like a victory lap. I feel like the 1.5 version is maybe what we'd consider like the final form of trash goblin. And unless it goes nuts and we get to just like completely indulge ourselves. Right. Which would be great. But then it made sense to kind of have this like extra chapter that we wanted to kind of add on there. So yeah, it's going to be, you know, several hours of content and and it'll all feed into the main game. So you get kind of quite a lot of gameplay out of it, even if you're, you know, going to be fresh to the game when all of that comes out. So yeah, it's exciting.
Now on the Kickstarter, you are offering the digital goblin plush. Is there any way that item could be offered to console gamers?
We would hope so. All of the DLC kind of came along after, most of it came along after the after the porting process was kicked off, and I believe some of it is rolled in and some of it isn't. So I'm not sure the exact kind of spread across the different platforms. I think PC is ahead of the consoles. Unfortunately, it's just kind of the nature of the thing, right? We can fix a patch and just upload it on Steam and that sort of thing, but we have to be a bit more, you know, there's a bit more process to the porting. So we would hope that we will eventually catch the console versions up. At the minute, they might be behind, but only in terms of those kind of like cosmetic little bits and bobs. But yeah, one day our goal is that, you know, Trash Goblin is exactly the same on all platforms. But honestly, one of the biggest things was we were like, we don't even know at this point how to, you know, add a DLC on, I don't know, the PlayStation back end, right, on the system. So we're like let's just leave that complication for like when we've got a bit more time, that sort of
cross that bridge, yeah, when you get to it.
exactly.
Were console versions part of the initial plan, or was that like a stretch goal?
So we didn't actually do any stretch goals for the Kickstarter, because we had a guy sort of Thomas from ICO Partners, who's like Mr. Kickstarter, and he's kind of like anti stretch goals for various reasons. Doesn't really matter, but the point was, we were like, let's make it really contained. So like the campaign is just like, if we reach this much funding, you will get the game on PC, and everything else is a question mark, right? And we'd always dreamed to get it on console, so it's like a literal dream come true that it's out there now. But it always had to depend on the performance of the game on Steam, and we were fortunate enough that it's done well. Yeah, like it's not like a breakout success that everyone's heard of, or that, you know, we don't get you know, updates for free. You know, we can't just I don't know. I saw, what was it? Someone, there was an article about an indie dev and why they don't localize their game. And I'm like, that news spot could have been used for some unheard of indie. But because that indie is famous, you know, you kind of get like a free pass, which is, I mean, it's fine. I just want to be there. I'm just a bit envious, you know. But yeah, so basically we've done really well for the team size that we are, and the fact that we're self-publishing it, you know, we control everything, and it's, you know, everything's up to us. We don't have to change the game in any way that we don't want to, which is amazing. But it didn't do so well that it was just like, oh, it's, we should absolutely convert this to all the platforms we can. But over time, it's built and built and built. And, you know, we just had our second daily deal like a couple of weeks ago, and it like absolutely smashed all of our expectations. So every time we get it out there in front of people in a new way, whether that's like a discount or an expansion or whatever, it just seems to keep finding new fans, new goblins. And that's just like, that's the best. It's so cool. Like, yeah, knowing that people love it that much is amazing. And then we keep finding more people for our community. And yeah, it's lovely.
No, I actually had seen someone stream it, and that was like a year or two ago, I think. I don't know how long ago it was, if it was a demo, if it was the game, but I was really happy to see it on consoles because it looked really fun.
Thank you. Yeah, it's delightful. We're so excited. And, you know, we're like, oh, the Switch version, we don't have like touch controls on it yet. You know, maybe we will, you know, but it's everything. We've had to do everything so carefully, right? Like, because of all of our time is just so precious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That we haven't been able to just like on the Switch.
No, unfortunately not. It's basically a console version is like the same across all of them. So none of the platforms really have any uniqueness. But like, we're looking at the Switch 2, and like, you've got the mouse controls, and you're like, well, hello, like, this would be perfect, right? Yeah, there's so much cool stuff we could do with that. And like the idea of, yeah, the gyro, just like rotating the chipping puzzle, right? And then like stabbing with the other one. There's so much cool stuff we could do. So fingers crossed. It just needs to keep selling, and we'll get there.
Speaking of mouse controls and preferring console, PC, all that fun stuff, I love the fact that this is a Play Anywhere title on Xbox, and that you get it on Series and on Xbox PC, because I first played it on my Xbox, and my wife was watching Netflix earlier, so I fired it up on my PC, and not only did I get to continue where I left off, but using the analog stick on a controller to rotate an item and using the mouse to click and clean the item, oh my god, it's like a world changer.
That's the way to play. I love that. That's
hybrid controller mouse, and it worked really, really well.
I love it. You've upcycled two control methods together like a true goblin. I love it. I've not tried that. I need to go and try that.
Pot handle on the goblin doll head. So good. He's a unicorn now. Oh, so what are you playing these days? What are you enjoying when you're not working on stuff?
Oh my gosh, it's such a weird like mix of stuff, because part of my job is to stay, you know, up to date with what's going on, and you know, so our next game, we're sort of running a few tests in Discord with players with their next game, or what might be our next game, I should say. It's not certain yet, but that's something that's very derived from, or like inspired by, kind of survivors, like, so like, you know, your Vampire Survivors, your Mega Bonk and things like that, which sounds weird, right? It's another game in the Trash Goblin universe. And we're hoping that people like it enough that we move forward with it. We're quite cautious about that stuff. So I played a lot of Survivors games. Well, it's like a non-violent one at the moment, so it's all about digging. I won't say anymore. I'll let people go and have a snoop around, see if they can find it or gain access. But it's kind of cool. We're quite interested in like the twist that we're trying to bring to that sort of genre. So yeah, I've been playing, like, I did basically 100% Mega Bonk when that came out, because it was just, the timing was interesting. But then I've played way too much Ark Raiders recently. Since it came out, I've been, that really got its hooks into me. I think I've got over 100 hours in that at this point. That game is incredible. There's just, it's such a drama generator. I don't know if any of you have played it.
I've played it a little bit. Yep.
I've never heard of it.
I have sat in a Discord watching wrestling while two of my friends would play Ark Raiders together. And it has led to sound clips like, let's see. I don't know why! That's one of them. Yeah. We had this one. I like that one.
Oh, I thought he was just coming that time. Okay.
No. we got...
Oh! You gotta be fucking kidding me!
That was when and another guy were fighting a boss. They killed the boss and the other guy turned on him.
Yep. Yeah, I feel that I can kind of connect all the emotions that are coming through in each of those. Yeah, I've been that person. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's why we keep a history of his reactions on Discord.
that is incredible. That soundboard is legit. I love it. That game is, like, it can be frustrating. It can be, like, completely, like, you know, like, sort of just devastating when bad things happen. But the drama is always, like, absolute gold, and the mix of, like, you know, is another player going to be an arsehole or not?
The answer is always yes, they are. That's the point.
It kind of depends on who you play with in Ark Raiders, because if you play nice, you'll more likely get played or get paired in games with other nicer players. But if you kill others a lot, you're gonna get into lobbies where you're fighting for your life.
Yep. It's super interesting. So, like, I kind of run a code of conduct where where I'm like, I will never shoot first. But if someone aggros me, I will intend to finish the fight. And, you know, about 50-50 I win, and 50% of the time the person who, you know, gets the first shot off does win. But it just felt like the right way to play, and over time it has meant that, like, people tend to be, or servers tend to be a little less aggro, so that's nice. But the third thing I've been playing just literally today, I'm sort of on the last dungeon, is it's one of the more old school Zelda games. It was on the GBA. It's called Minish Cap.
Hell yeah.
And I never played it when it came out. I'm a huge, like, Zelda is my favorite series of all time. I never played it when it came out. I saw there were a bunch of, I don't know why, there were a bunch of articles online recently about, like, the best GBA games on Switch Online. And I was like, oh my God, there's, like, a Zelda sat right there that I could just go and play today, right now. And I did. And then I've been completely hooked. I think it's brilliant. It's absolutely amazing. Absolutely fantastic.
What's your favorite Zelda?
Oh, it's...
Tunic.
I've not played Tunic, but I'm in the mindset now. I'm like, oh, maybe I should go play Tunic next, right? Like, it's the natural
progression. Yeah, you need to go play that, because the fact that you haven't played that yet is blasphemy, as far as I'm concerned.
That's fair. I'm in your church, and I've blasphemed. I will go and repent. I really should. That's been on my list for too long. My favorite Zelda is probably Breath of the Wild. It's the one that I think Tears of the Kingdom is better, in inverted commas, but Breath of the Wild was the one that gave me the same sense of wonder and, like, joy that Ocarina of Time did when I first played that. It felt like a complete, like, a new landscape of gaming had arrived, the same way, like, when 3D arrived with the N64 properly. Like, Mario 64, Legend of Zelda, Ocarina of Time, they were like, I don't understand how this is real. I don't understand how, like, enormous and exciting and mysterious this whole thing is. And Breath of the Wild had the same effect on me at a point in my life where I was like, not jaded, but like, I've been making games my professional life, and so it felt really important and special that it still managed to make me feel like I was basically 12 again playing one of those games again. So that was the one. Yeah,
I always go with Link's Awakening on Game Boy. That's my favorite.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's really good.
I love the retro Zeldas more than the 3D Zeldas, and I think as good as Link to the Past is, it's just a bit too long at the end, and I think Link's Awakening is just perfect length.
Yep. Pacing and game length is so crucial, isn't it? Especially on those kinds of games where you're like, I think I know what's going to happen, I just need it to finish now. Like, I've had my fill. But yeah.
Oh, man, I know we've been chatting for a while. Is there anything about the game you wanted to talk about that we didn't bring up?
Is there? I should have thought about this.
We're naturally not good at our job, so we usually rely on the devs to tell us the important stuff.
No, this has been good. What's important to tell? Well, I just think if anyone here who's listening to this is like, they just want to chill out with a game. Like, they're looking for a game that's like, just fits around everything else they're playing, that has like no pressure, like no fail states, and just goes in just wanting that. Like, I know so many people who second screen Trash Goblin, and I'm really happy about that, right? They're like watching, I don't know, Love is Blind on one screen, and then they're playing Trash Goblin on another, and I'm like, that's it. It's the game that fits around you and your needs, and if you just want to zone out and relax and forget the world for a bit, I think it's basically perfect for you. There's some annoyances. We're still working on it. There's still bugs, right? But if the idea of something that's just really, really super chill and no pressure is kind of what you need right now, go and have a look. Go and play the demo. The progress from the demo carries over into the game. And see what you think. We'd love to have more goblins joining the movement.
Well, where can people keep up to date with you and what you're doing?
Well, if you check out Spilt Milk Studios on Blue Sky, I think the best place to come is our Discord. So it's discord.gg/spiltmilk, SPILTMILK. We are very active in there. We actually have a separate Discord, which is our dev Discord. That's our like virtual office, but we are active in the public one like all day every day, and we'd love to hear from you and talk to you and see your little goblin shops and what mad trinkets you've made.
Yeah, Aki, show us what kind of fucked up things you make by putting weird shit together.
I can do that.
You put weird shit together. Aki, any final questions on your end?
I can't think of any. I'm bad at this.
Brie, what about you? What kind of questions do you have left?
I would love to know where the name Spilt Milk comes from for the studio.
Oh, so
is there a story?
It's
about?
Like, it's not the most exciting story. It's funny in that I take great pride in, like, the one thing I genuinely bring to any project is a good name. Like, I feel like that's what I do. And the team runs with it and makes a great game. So Trash Goblin, that was me. Dig In, our next one, that's me. Et cetera. I'm known as like the achievement namer and all of this kind of stuff, right? I'm the pun guy, whatever. But then the name of the studio was literally a result of me coming up with a list of like 20 names and my girlfriend at the time going, these are all terrible. And she was right. She was so right. And going, what, you know, don't cry about it. And then that was, I wish I was the one who kind of like linked the pun, but that was it. It was like, there you go. She suggested it. And there you go. And it was like, do you know what? It sticks. It's memorable. And it suggests immediately a cute little logo. So it just felt right.
Yeah. Very cool.
Beautiful. What else you got, Brie?
I just had one more thing that, you know, I could have probably shoehorned in earlier. Was how important was accessibility to you? And what kinds of things did you put in place to help with that?
Oh, I mean, so over the course of the project, it's something that grew so much in terms of importance. Like, the whole ethos of the game and the studio is like the same thing. It's like welcoming and supportive and generous and that sort of thing. And like when we got to early access launch, and the game came out, and we had a few people basically saying, hey, it'd be really great if you could give us some options around the chipping or the clicking, because it's very repetitive, there's a lot of it. And we're like, you know what, that's really dumb that we didn't think of that. Yes, we should put that in. And from there, we just saw the response from the community, and we're like, I mean, hey, this is wonderful. People are just like so happy that we did it. And so we started asking, what else can we do? And obviously there were some natural things. We're like, oh, we could do the same with the cleaning and other mechanics. And it felt, the more we did it, the more it felt the right thing to do, right? So I'd hesitate to say we set out with like a mission to kind of like approach accessibility, but as soon as we saw the effect it had, it was like, oh my God, why weren't we doing this from just the very start?
The community is just as important as coming out with that intention. So that's thing to hear. I personally liked that you put in like two or three different ways to move around the shop space, including like the bumpers. You could quick click to the eyeball, and then you could, you know, have the tiles that you could click on as well. I thought that was a really great, like lots of options of how to move around the space. I thought that was an accessibility feature as well. So I feel like you did some good stuff in there. I know Aki said she was a big fan of the hover.
Makes my fucking day.
Yep. And so, that's the thing. Everyone ends up having a different favorite combination of ways that they want the game to respond or to be playable, right? And it's just really lovely. Yeah. We even had someone say thank you so much, because they can now basically hold their baby in one arm and play with the other. And we're like, oh my God. I mean, like, it's so perfect.
Jacob's gonna love this game because he'll get to hold his wife in one arm and play with the other. He's always looking for good
one-armed games. That's definitely what he's going to be holding. Yeah.
Oh, come on. You know, he talks about it all the time, Aki.
He does.
He's always looking for one-armed games to play so he could just cuddle with his wife on the couch. It's adorable.
That's lovely. That is lovely.
M317 wants to know, what's your favorite achievement in the game?
Oh, my days. What is my favorite achievement in the game?
The most evil achievements in the game.
Well, yeah, there's one that's like really mean because it's basically find, clean, and upcycle and sell every single trinket. It's not quite every single trinket, but it might as well be. And that's mean because combined with the RNG, you can't. So there's a system in the game eventually where you can order trinkets from the characters, but they arrive cleaned. So people who are trying to 100% it, they regularly go, oh, great, I'll just use that. And then they realize that, oh, no, I actually have to find them. And that feels particularly mean. Yeah.
Because I noticed that if I combine the items together, does that count as each one of them being sold? Or is that a combination and I have to do each one individually as well as different combos?
I believe that it counts all of them as individual. So like if you have upcycled them together, it should count against all of them. If it doesn't.
Oh, thank God.
Then it will be on our list of things to fix. But I believe that is the case.
Okay, good. Because I have a tendency to just combine everything into something that's clearly supposed to all go together.
Yep.
And then sell it. I refuse to sell it before then because it just bugs me when they're like, oh yeah, I need a handle. How about I just give you the whole dagger? I'm not giving you just a handle to a dagger. That's stupid. Here's a dagger. Buy it.
And they always do. They always buy it.
Yes, and I appreciate that.
They're very easy to please in the game.
Yeah. And yeah, hey, the more money I get, the better. I'm cool with that.
Right? If only it was like that in real life.
Yeah, if only all customers were like that.
Well, speaking of money, how much is this game? Where can people buy it?
So it is, I believe it's $19 or equivalent on Steam, and the same or thereabouts on console. I think, you know, they're slightly limited on the console options of what we can price things. But yeah, and it's on Steam for PC, Xbox Series X and S, PlayStation 5, and Switch 1. But obviously you can just buy it and play it on your Switch 2, and it will just run nicer. So yay.
Are you guys going to look into a Switch 2 native version with all the special features and shit?
We would be delighted to do that. I think
if you
anyone
get your hands on
if you can get on a day, exactly. So if anyone out there is listening, they have a line on a Switch 2 dev kit, let me know. I heard, hit me up.
I think Nintendo's looking for dev kits still.
Yeah. They're like, we had a whole warehouse full. We don't know where we put it, right? Like, yeah.
Jim lost the key again.
Dang it.
Oh, man. Well, Andrew, I want to thank you so much for coming on, hanging out, and chatting with us. It has been an absolute pleasure. Again, the game is Trash Goblin. Go out there, pick it up. We are going to take a quick break. We will be back with more show. We should have our party cast-ish crew. Purnell, Aki, you should be there. I think Tim will be there. Well, I don't know. We'll find out. Horacolite should be that. People, more show. We are going to listen to some ghosts and goblins from the mini bosses. We'll be right back. How's that sound?
Great.
Damn right.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew, any final words to wrap this up?
Just be nice to people. I think that's what I want to put out in the world. Be nice to people, and if that means buying Trash Goblin, then so be it.
Buy Trash Goblin and the plush. I want that Kickstarter plush. Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for sticking around. Another huge thanks to the Spilt Milk team for coming on, hanging out, chatting about Trash Goblin. Aki, that was a good time, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I actually feel awesome. Like I did good for once with an interview.
You chimed in. You had questions. You done did good-ish.
Yeah. Usually
showed
you have
up
to
and
tell
she done
me.
Did good. And then yes, I was yes, there like, did. Eh.
You always do good. Fuck off.
Nah. Anyway,
you're usually the one that has to tell me I did good. What the fuck? We're not switching places. We know.
I don't like the host. Stop pushing it. Anyway, we got other people joining us right now for the review squad. We've got Purnell here. We've got Tim Ekibis here, and we've got Horacolite here. How is everybody doing?
Yeah, I'm okay.
Yeah, I'm good, Shane.
Collectively decadent.
Good talk. Good talk. Tim, how's things going on in your neck of the woods?
Oh God, I'm just so fucking busy. That's
a lot of work.
So busy. Yeah, a lot of work. Well, it turns out when you have a full-time job and a full-time kid and you're the president of your union and you run a martial arts school, you're very busy.
Wait, you run a martial arts school?
I run martial arts classes. I think to say I run a school would imply that I had a building, but I don't. I just rent space.
Damn, that's still impressive. Cool. Yeah. You were getting shit done.
Yeah, I run. Yeah, and there's been a lot going on on all fronts lately. So yeah.
And Wednesday night you watch wrestling.
And Wednesday night I watch wrestling.
Oh, that's the good thing going on.
Most weeks.
Trying to convince Purnell to join us one of these weeks.
He should. It's a good time. If you, even if you don't like wrestling, well, you will shortly after you start watching with us, but it's a good time with fun people.
I can appreciate that. It really boils down to just the time.
Yeah.
Time is, time is precious and rare.
I've been setting aside my Wednesday nights religiously for 6 years now. Since
something like that,
spring of 2020. Yeah, when I had nothing to do in spring of 2020, we started watching wrestling. It was the thing I looked the most forward to. That is no exaggeration. was Wednesday nights.
It was basically the apocalypse at the time. No one knew what the hell was going on.
It was the escape.
We had that every week,
and watching like clockwork. AEW. And since, you know, my schedule has filled up, I have been a hard, like, nothing goes on Wednesday nights unless it
you held on to that day.
To. Yes, I did. Because
and occasionally, you know, Sunday or Saturdays, depending on
and the papes. Yeah, absolutely, making it for the papes. But
I can definitely appreciate that logic. That's me. Like, I have like a Wednesday thing where I go to King of Prussia, and I guess like every other Wednesday, and then somewhere in like in 2020, I guess it was 23 when we started doing it. We started doing the alternate Wednesdays to be a thing where like, hey, all those board games you haven't opened up. None of us, we all have a bunch of open board games. How about we choose this day to just dig one out and remove the shrink wrap and learn the rules and make ourselves play our shit.
Do y'all get together and then play it then? Or does it just go back on the
shelf?
We
play.
Okay, good.
No, we play it. We choose one week. Each week, one person gets the full reign of the table. So they choose one or two games that had never been opened before. You bring them out. You remove the shrink wrap, learn the rules, and play the game.
Gotcha. I wasn't sure if like you guys just hung out at home and were like, I'm going to open this one today and then look at the rule book and then talk to each other online like we do. That was fun.
Back it goes. No. We meet at a specific friend's house. It's not a bunch of
it. This book had color and pictures. I like it.
All the color. All the pictures. At
least the new pictures. But yeah, man. Yeah, if you're home before 10 o'clock, jump in and watch wrestling with us.
Okay. I'll definitely keep that in mind. If I can pull it off, I'll do it. I'll check it out. There's always like an off Wednesday where neither thing happened. So.
When's the next King one?
King of Prussia is the first and third Wednesday, and then the other thing is basically alternate Wednesdays, but what usually happens is when there's five Wednesdays in a month, that last Wednesday has nothing. So that ends up generally being the opportunity. Like, oh, I can do something else.
All right, April 29th, Purnell's going to watch wrestling with us. Put it in your calendar.
Right now, my calendar is my phone. But I say that's true. I'll keep that in mind.
Yeah, anytime, man. We'd love to have you. You know what else I'd love to have? Some games.
Well, you got game. You're married.
I was trying to segue.
I ruined it. Ha-ha! In your face.
No, I guess instead, Horror Acolyte, how are you doing?
You know, live. People in the house are sick right now, so I'm trying to avoid that. Yeah, it's been bad. My dad had pneumonia there for a little bit. He's still kind of recovering, so he's doing better though.
Good.
So. No, it was bad.
It's good to hear he's on the mend. That is very good news indeed.
Sure.
Playing anything fun lately?
A lot of the review game I'm doing tonight, and then on top of that, finished Hell Is Us a little while ago, which was okay. It ended up being actually kind of disappointing, but it still wasn't too bad overall.
I actually bought that hoping it would be good. It looked good.
Yeah, I don't want to delve too much into why it was not what I expected, but yeah, it had some shortfalls. I think maybe some misconceptions too, based on like pre-described notions for like souls likes and stuff. Like a lack of unique bosses. We'll say that was a pretty rough one.
Yeah, the knack for making it not too great. explodes.
Yeah, like, I don't want to spoil too much in the game, but there's, like, literally pretty much no boss fights. It, like, with individualized, like, characters. It's really weird. I was surprised by that, but anyways.
That's very weird.
Yeah.
Just, like, random guys, then, as the bosses? Or just groups of people? Is it, like, waves?
So, essentially what happens is, like, yeah, it's, like, enemies you kind of like see throughout the game already, and then you'll fight kind of additional waves of them. But there's a couple special fights where they're kind of boss fights, but they're like just because the arena's changed and it's done like in a very stylized way, and those are pretty cool. Like I liked what they did with them, but like there was no like, you know, here's a named character, like a special character, like you're gonna fight this, you know, special character now. There was maybe something slightly similar to that at one point, but like not really. And I don't know, I was kind of let down by that aspect of the game. But
was the game hard? So.
That was another issue I had with it, was the difficulty. It has 3 preset difficulties and then a customizable scaling one for a few of the options. I played it on the hardest difficulty for like the presets, and I'm not a Souls veteran by any means. I haven't played any of the FromSoft ones, but I play the Souls adjacent games, and I brute forced my shit like all the way through this game. And I like didn't use any items the entire game. I like didn't use barely any of the power ups or my equipment.
Wow.
On hard, I don't know why the preset for the hardest difficulty was that easy, but yeah, it was not that bad. I don't know.
Jeez. You know, I feel like there's going to be hard.
Super Meat Boy.
Oh, you're goddamn right. which leads us to the first game to talk about tonight. See how that works out?
Nah, don't get me. I was trying to ruin it again. You should have stopped him, horror accolade. You had the opportunity.
I did. I yeah.
But anyway, first game, Super Meat Boy 3D, developed by Sluggerfly and Team Meat, published by Head Up. It released March 30th, Xbox Series X and S, Switch 2, PS5, and PC, $24.99. Super Meat Boy 3D is a tough-as-nails platformer where you play as an animated cube of meat who's trying to save his girlfriend, who happens to be made of bandages, from an evil fetus in a jar wearing a tux in 3D. Our meaty hero will leap from walls, over seas of buzzsaws, through crumbling caves of pools of trash, of sacrificing his own well-being to save his damsel in distress in 3D. And if a bunch of levels weren't enough, we have enough epic boss fights, and there's tons of unlockable secrets in 3D. Tim, Purnell, both you covered this. Tim, how about you start us off? What is going on in Super Meat Boy 3D?
It's Meat Boy, but it's in 3D. Book it. So, Purnell, where are you at with the original, with Super Meat Boy 2D?
Oh, the original game? Oh, yeah. That game was cracked to me. It was at a point where I was competing for best times and shit.
Oh, man. If only we'd been Xbox Live friends at the time, because I was doing the same thing. I feel like we must have been, but... Yeah, I adore Super Meat Boy 2-Dimension Edition. I played the shit out of that game. That's like a top 3 Xbox Live Arcade experience for me. Also, like one of the best game soundtracks of all time.
The original one, anyway, at least for me.
Yeah, yeah. Danny B was just playing some of those tracks at MAGFest, and they hit. Like, it's such a good soundtrack. But yeah, I love that game. So just to kind of frame where I'm coming from when it talks to Super Meat Boy 3D, because it's like you're taking, I don't know, it just historically, I feel like when you take a really tight 2D platformer and you try to do similar in 3D, it doesn't work quite as well, you know? Because it's just the, you know, the controls, the spacing, the dimensions of it, it doesn't quite hit the same. And for me, like, so this is, it is very similar to Super Meat Boy 2D, like the same structure where you have worlds where there's 15-ish levels and you don't necessarily need to clear all of them to fight the boss. But when you do clear the boss, then you unlock dark world versions of the levels, which are some real deep fuckery. But you know, for these, you know, regular level, Meat Boy level, you are trying to get from one end to the other, and really clearing most levels is going to take you, I don't know, 15, 20, 30 seconds, if that. Like, they're not long, but you got to learn.
You're going to say 15, 30 tries.
Well, that comes later.
Yeah, that, you'll get there eventually. But there's, you know, hazards and traps, and you just kind of got to learn the level. There was, you know, levels, you know, in Light World side where every now and then it's like the magic comes together and I would just ace a level. That's rare. Usually, you know, you're learning the jumps, the timing of the traps, where you got to go, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, they added from Super Meat Boy, so it is 3D now. And you might have heard, I feel like one of the conceits is that you now have like this air dash, so that you can kind of maneuver yourself in the air more. Like he was pretty maneuverable in the air in 2D Meat Boy, but in this, like, you really get like a lot of hang time to kind of move around and like almost fly around. Like you're almost like fluttering sometimes with the amount of hang time you get, which is interesting because you can kind of, it makes it really easy to skip certain jumps and parts of the levels, just completely skip certain things. If you can just kind of mark the distance correctly, you can wall run in this game, you know, wall run, dash, jump, wall run again, just stringing things together. And the whole thing works, I think. What do you think, Pernell?
I'll be honest with you. Like, I know we'll eventually get to the 2D versus 3D later, but I will say for the sake of just this game, I think it does work pretty well, better than I expected it to.
Yeah.
Though it doesn't hurt that I play a lot of, like, I've been playing a lot of 3D platformers in recent years too. It's just none that particularly have the Meat Boy grind to them, as it were.
No.
I will say one thing about the 3D that will either make someone angry or you'll just get used to is the fact that due to it being in 3D, there are certain platform sections or ledges or safe spots on walls that might be more obscured by other elements of the game that will throw you off your rhythm.
I found it harder to like read a level just because there was just more stuff on there going around. And occasionally I had trouble just kind of figuring out like where I could go or what was safe or what I could land on, because of that. It just didn't quite read clearly. And especially like if you're moving fast, it almost, you know, creates situations where of course you're going to run into something because you just can't parse out what you're looking at fast enough. Which, you know, dying and retrying is a big part of the original game. Of course it's part of it here, but it creates some deaths that probably you wouldn't have, on the like 2D version. They're less like skill based ones and more just kind of like interpreting the level ones, I guess.
Because I will say like the first, oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, go on.
Oh, I'm just going to go back on that point again. Like the first time I noticed that as being a particular dilemma for me was actually one of the earlier Dark World levels where there were buzzsaws on the ground, be any level really. And the crystals lined out, and I was like, how am I supposed to make this jump in a way where I could actually clear these buzzsaws without, you know, screwing up? And the actual, unless that was not meant to be, but I found it, there was a platform behind Crystal that I had to just kind of instinctively try to jump onto and then jump off of that and get across with another air dash. And I was like, I wonder if that was meant to be the way or if I just came across a way to get around it. But either way, I wasn't expecting to have to jump behind scenery on in the actual level to get by.
Yeah, and there was times when I feel like maybe the hitboxes of those buzzsaws was a little bigger than I thought they would be, you know, and they were catching me, because, I mean, maybe they weren't, maybe they're just very precise and they're catching, like, Meat Boy's arm, and it's just harder for me to parse it out, but there were some deaths where I was like, I don't really feel like that got me, but it did get me. I will say, initially, I tried to play this game on Steam Deck, and I don't think that's a great way to play this game, just with everything crammed down on that screen, it made it a lot more difficult to read levels. I also just, as personal preference, like if a game is like Twitch control heavy, I prefer to have a controller in my hands versus playing it on a portable. Like my hands will get cramped up a lot quicker.
That, and if you throw your controller, it's not a $800 handheld.
Yeah, I'm not throwing my controller, but I was definitely much more comfortable playing it with a controller on my PC here, like on a you know, full size monitor, versus just like, just didn't fit well. It's certainly playable. It was playable. Like I got through the whole first world on the Steam Deck, but even then I was just kind of like, I think I would like this better if it were not on the Steam Deck. Whereas that's usually where I prefer to play. But, and so this is the thing. I still like the game. I still think it's good, but it's like, it doesn't really come close to the same heights as Super Meat Boy 2-dimension version for me, like really in any way. It's still good, but like I said, that's like a top three Xbox Live arcade game for me. It's a game that I played obsessively. It is a game where I think the soundtrack is incredible. The soundtrack here is good, but it's just not one of the best video game soundtracks of all time. So yeah. Therefore, you know, it's like you're up against a very high bar here.
Is it a memorable soundtrack, or is it just kind of like, eh?
I don't think it's that memorable. Which is funny because it's Ridiculon, which also did Mugenics, which has a very memorable soundtrack, a agonizingly memorable soundtrack. But all those songs in Mugenics have lyrics to them, so like, of course, that's going to stick in your head more. But this just kind of felt like, okay, this is good, like, I don't want to say like NXT entrance song from 7 years ago, like, you know, rock, but like, it's that kind of like, okay, this is good, but it's not really super distinctive is what I was getting out of it. Whereas like those songs in the first game, like really, really stuck with me as I was grinding through those levels. And this was like much, much less so. Like it's good, but it's not like hooking
in. Fuck with Danny B.
You can't, and it's fine. Like, again, not bad. Like, you know, playing the game, navigating the levels, like doing the platforming, like it's all good. It's just not as good as one of the best things that there is in this genre. And like having kind of the floatier jumps and the air dashes does create some like new possibilities for navigating the levels, for like just skipping hazards and like making it just to the edge of like a wall or something. So then maybe you can just skip the next like piece of kind of the set piece there. But it just doesn't feel quite as good overall. Like many, you know, 3D platformers just don't feel quite as good as 2D do. I will say, I don't feel like it didn't feel as precise as like Astrobot did for me, because Astrobot had those speedrun levels, and I think, you know, it, just different structure to the levels, but I feel like the overall control of Astrobot felt tighter and cleaner than here in Meat Boy.
And Astrobot was a very special game.
It was, yeah.
That's so, something you don't get all the time.
Yeah, I'm trying not to, like, you know, diss on it. It's just like, you know, it's not as good as the best, but it will scratch that itch. There are tons of secrets. There's, you know, there's a bandage collectible in every level to grab. There is
getting an A+. They are a lot harder to find than they used to be. Oh, God.
Yeah, yeah. And that, well, yeah. there's grinding for an A+ rating on each level, which is a time-based thing.
That's how it always was, though.
Sure, but it just has this, you know, and it has all an entire second set of levels, the Dark World levels too, so there's all this stuff to do and no shortage of content. And I think it actually, you know, it looks good, like nice graphical art style. One thing graphically, I don't know if you noticed this, Purnell, but one of the hallmarks of Super Meat Boy was that when you'd finish a level, you'd get the catharsis of watching like a playback of all of your runs simultaneously and all those Meat Boys dying. They do that in this game, but it's definitely not all of the Meat Boys. It's not every single run. It's like a selection of them. And it's still like quite a lot of them. But I was like watching them, I'm like, this isn't all of them. I know I died. I know I died a lot more doing this. But I'm guessing, like, you know, it couldn't handle
a memory limitation.
Yeah, probably a memory limitation that they just couldn't have that many out there. But that was like, it's a little disappointing to me. Like on one, because sometimes that's like the incentive that pushes you through a level to finish it and not just like put the game down. Because if you finish the level right then and there, you get to see all of this additional destruction of like 50 Meat Boys all getting like ripped apart. But then it's like, okay, it took me like 50 tries and then I see like 20, 25 Meat Boys. That's half the Meat Boys I was looking for. It's not quite as satisfying.
Yeah, I will say like it doesn't ring the same in that sense, but it still feels good in it. Cause like, I guess the best way for me to think about it is, and you may have already kind of touched on it yourself and the way you phrased it is that Super Meat Boy, the original game is the better game without a doubt. But some people will also say things like Super Mario Bros. 3 is better than Super Mario Galaxy or something like that. But with that said, I would still be very happy to play Super Mario Galaxy just as much as I'd still be pretty happy to play Super Meat Boy 2. It's scratching.
I don't think Super Meat Boy 3, I don't think this game's as good as Mario Galaxy. I don't think that.
Oh, heavens no. But it hits that same comparison between the 2D game versus the 3D game.
Yeah. I don't think this is going to resonate as like an all-time classic. It's just going to be a little bit. I know I'm trying not to like sound because I'm going to recommend this game. It's just,
when you have something as iconic as Super Meat Boy, it's hard.
And it's been 15 years.
Follow up in those footsteps.
Yeah, it's been 15 years, and you know they're doing the thing, and you know it's cool and it's enjoyable. As a revisit to Meat Boy, and it's satisfying and the content is there. It's just, you know, I don't even know if this would make like my top 5, top 10 of the year. We'll see how it goes, you know, but I'll be like, no, that was cool. That was good. That was neat. You know, it scratched the itch a little bit.
Well, it clocks in at $24.99. I need some verdicts.
Yeah, that sounds good. That's a good price. I thought you were going to say $29.99, and I still 24. Probably said, yeah, but yeah, $25. That's a totally, you will get your value out of that, and I think it's good for that price. It's well made. It's fun. There's lots of stuff to do. Like if you are looking for this kind of grindy, platformy, punishing challenge, like this is a good game for it.
Very good, Purnell.
For me, I'd give it a solid buy. Like we said earlier, it's not as good as Super Meat Boy proper, but it's still a pretty fun game, and I think you'll get some solid mileage out of it, enough to justify it as a buy.
Mm-hmm.
All right, good stuff. With that, Tim, you are done. Thank you, as always, for joining and hanging out
with
us.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Always a pleasure.
In the middle of typing an email I got to send out tonight.
Well, we will let you go so you can enjoy the rest of your night. And
all right.
I'll catch you tomorrow for Rassles.
Good night. Yeah, see ya. Good night.
Take care.
Have a good night, good sir.
Night tonight.
All right, moving on. Next up, Darwin's Paradox, developed by ZDT Studio, published by Konami, provided to us for this coverage by Konami. Thank you, Konami. Aki, say thank you.
Thank you.
Released April 2nd on Xbox Series and PC, Switch 2, PS5, and PC for $24.99. Embark on a grand adventure worthy of a true animated movie with Darwin, an octopus as charming as he is clever, ripped from the ocean and trapped in a massive and mysterious industrial complex. With his extraordinary intelligence and incredible abilities, swimming, camouflage, and many other fascinating skills, help him overcome the most formidable traps and dangers in this captivating platformer adventure puzzle game. Aki, what is Darwin's Paradox?
Okay, in this, you play as a little octopodia, and you're taken out of the ocean by an alien aircraft thing, spacecraft, whatever you want to call it. And you and your friend have both been taken, and you're just dumped into a landfill for reasons. And you start trying to find your way back home. Along the way, you find a lot of things that kind of want to kill you. Namely, robots that decide they're going to off you, or mice that decide your food. Things like that, you know, fans that don't think at all. You know, stuff. And yeah, you're just trying to sneak your way through everywhere because you don't have any means of doing anything to them. Instead, you have just standard stuff that an octopus can do. You can climb up things because you have suckers on your tentacles. You can camouflage, and you can shoot ink at things, usually to create a more or less smoke screen underwater. And yeah, you're put through various levels in different chapters. There are a fuck ton of chapters because every section is broken down between a bunch of areas. For instance, there's a bunch of levels called Dang This Stinks and Stings, and there's five levels to it. There's another one called Kicking Cans. There's seven levels to it. Within these, you know, you have to sneak through from point A to point B. Sometimes that requires jumping around on things that are moving. Other times, yeah, basically. Other times it means, you know, hiding under stuff so people don't see you, and moving them around so that it, when people aren't looking, so they don't turn around and notice you and kick you back to square one like a bunch of dickheads, which have had to happen a few thousand times. Yeah, it's really just a stealth game where you move around. You get the ability to walk on the walls, ceilings, everywhere. If you can reach it, you can probably climb on it, unless you're covered in radioactive goop or something is covered in, like, oil to prevent you from climbing. So otherwise, everything can be climbed on, except for people. Don't try to climb on those. That's a bad idea. They will kick the shit out of you. there's a lot of ways to die in this. A whole bunch of ways to die. Be it from landing on spikes, from robots finding and kicking the shit out of you, aliens zapping you with ray guns, mines blowing you to hell.
Is this one of those games that gives you achievements for dying in X many different ways?
Surprisingly, no. I don't think so. I can't actually view the achievement list yet. It isn't viewable. However, apparently at least some, if not all of it, has been leaked in the trophies. So from there, there's was like one death that got counted for an achievement, but none of the others do it, which is kind of a shame. And yeah, so you're going around. Sometimes there's occasionally a, I guess I'll call it a boss battle, where you have to deal with something, but it's not really fighting it. It's mostly just figuring out how to get the fuck away from it, or how to hide to get around to where you need to go. For instance, in one level, there's a giant fish that's chasing after you, trying to eat you, and you have to figure out how to get out of there. One of the worst levels in the entire game, actually. There's another level where a giant crab robot is chasing after you and destroying the environment behind you, and you just have to keep, basically play keep away from it. Things like that. Yeah, the abilities that you have are not all unlocked from the very beginning, because your Octopodia has had 10 bells of shit kicked out of it and has lost its memories, more or less, at the start of the game. So occasionally in a level, the your little character will be like, oh yeah, I remember being taught this. And then it shows a little video of the octopus friend showing you how to do different things, like turning invisible and shooting ink, stuff like that. And then you're able to use it from that point forward for the rest of the game. And those abilities are usually really required really quickly. There are typically various ways of dealing with things, which is kind of nice. Not always, but in a bunch of areas there are. In underwater levels especially, because typically you'll find stuff floating around, and you can, like, block the automated turret's eyesight with it by grabbing onto it and staying behind it so they can't see you as you drag it around. or you can just shoot your ink through and create a giant screen of inky blackness that I can't go through and just go around the other side. Things like that. So it all leads you going to the same direction, but you have different ways of getting there a little bit. No real major differences or anything. But it still is fun just knowing that you have, oh, I can do it this way or I can do it that way. It's just interesting. It doesn't impact the story or anything. It's just a nice little cool thing that you can do. And, there are a shit ton of levels in this.
You mentioned that part. How are the visuals on this? Because looking at the store page, still shots look incredible. How is it in motion?
It is fucking gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. At least in some areas. Other areas, it doesn't look quite as good, but that's not because it's, you know, bad animation or anything. It's just because the colors are terrible because it's like an internally industrial area does not look good. It doesn't matter how good your animation style is, a bunch of gray walls and pipes are still gray walls and pipes, you know?
True. I'm talking more of like some of the open undersea areas that they showed on the store page.
All the undersea areas, except for I think like one, was absolutely gorgeous. And that one was meant to be, it was a real dark area. It's gorgeous. This game is really pretty and it doesn't really hold your hand either. Like, When I mentioned earlier how you could grab like a barrel and drag it down, or you could shoot your ink down, there are a lot of times where you can do that. I never noticed that I could use the ink that way for a very, very long time. I was almost at the end of the game when I realized I could do that. I could have done it from the start. It would have made so many sections so much easier. Instead, I was pushing around floating objects that I couldn't grab onto to create dark areas that I could go into to prevent me from being seen. So the game does not really hold your hand. You kind of just figure shit out. Thankfully, a lot of it is pretty intuitive. If you're smarter than I am, it's really intuitive, and that's not very hard to be. So
you said even I would enjoy this one.
Oh, yeah. I honestly don't really see very many people who would play this game and probably not be into it, because it's not like it's a precision platformer. It's pretty generous. It is a little finicky on controls every now and then, but that's, you know, the name of the game. It is what it is.
Yeah.
And it's just, all around, it's pretty generous. Like, even when you die, your respawn is usually the beginning of the room that you're in. Once you cross a threshold, you're immediately at a new save point, basically.
Alright, well, let's talk price on this one. It clocks in at $24.99. If you are able to get a pre-order in before it goes live, they have a pre-order skin pack that includes a dotted skin and a psyched skin, which is a psychedelic tie-dye looking skin that I am eager to check out, because I dropped the $25 at your recommendation. So give everybody the recommendation. $25. What do you think?
Oh, this is totally a buy it. This is one of the better games I've played so far this year. This has been a fantastic time.
Very good. All right, moving on. Next up is Ariana and the Elder Codex, developed by Idea Factory, Compile Heart and Hide, published by Idea Factory International, released March 24th, Switch, PS4, PS5, $29.99. The librarian Ariana's mission is to repair the seven hero codices, which have been altered. Due to the terrible damages, magic has vanished from the world. By utilizing special librarian magic that allows her to enter the codices, Ariana seeks to mend the books to bring back magic. Can Ariana safely repair each tome and unravel the mysteries hidden within the library? Pernell, tell us about Ariana and the Elder Codex.
So, as you mentioned earlier, you play as Ariana, and you are tasked with exploring codices. I usually say codexes. I'm tired. And
books.
Those are basically. I like that. Let's go with books, because that's That's my level right now. So you're tasked with exploring a series of different books, and each of these books represents a different world or stage. Let's call it that. And while you're in these levels, they are technically damaged. And by being damaged, it means a combination of things. One, there are tears in the pages that need to be mended. And then other aspects of it, the book is being, you know, ravaged by monsters, which you need to, you know, thrash out. And some of the tears are actually caused by monsters that inhabit the books. So you will basically platform through these levels, exploring, looking for treasures and items, and defeating monsters as you go, while simultaneously working to repair the books themselves to clear, air quotes, complete the stage in its entirety. So Ariana is what's known as a skilled librarian, more skilled than any of the other librarians in the world that she inhabits. With magic waning in the world and these books' degradation being the reason behind that, she is tasked with going inside and mending them. She's the only one capable of doing so. They do have back lore if you really want to get knee deep into understanding what all that actually means. But just know you walk into books and you beat things up in the books while also kind of being a bystander basically like a bystander viewing the story unfold that takes place inside the book through various story bits. Combat in this game, which for the record for me is probably the thing I like about it by far the most, is very similar to the combat in another game I reviewed for this show many, 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 many years ago called Super Daryl Deluxe. What that is that you have three face buttons that correspond to three different attacks, and these attacks can represent one of five different elements, being wind, fire, water, and earth. But then in addition, there's also a neutral element. You can equip up to six of these different attacks. Three with the by default, and then when you press the R2 button, you'll switch back to another set of three, so you can go back and forth between a total of six attacks. There is no MP in this game, so you don't have to worry about running out of magic points to be unable to cast magic anymore. However, each of your attacks does come with a cooldown. So typically, logically stated, the more powerful, the more, you know, the larger the area of effect for an attack, the more likely it's going to have a longer cooldown to it. But as you equip these things, you'll be trying to combo them as best you can to beat the stuffing out of enemies, to defeat them, and get the goods, which can be used to do things I'll talk about in a few. Each enemy in the game also has its own element that's associated with it. And if you hit it with the element that which it represents, it doesn't do as much damage. However, if you manage to hit it with the element that it's weak against, you will do more damage to it, and you will also fill up an elemental gauge that's associated with the enemy. If you manage to max out this elemental gauge, you'll cause what's called an elemental burst, which creates an explosion effect that affects the enemy and things that are located around it. And if you manage to get multiple enemies with multiple maxed out gauges at the same time, you can make quite the hell of a massive elemental burst scheme. In addition to that, as you complete levels in the game, most notably levels that are associated with the four elements, you will unlock the ability to charge up a gauge that will increase as you use magic of that corresponding element. And then when it does max out, you can trigger it to do more damage with spells of that element for a period of time. And also it'll kind of mutate the spells of that element to have bonus effects. For example, an early one might be like a water laser that you can fire. But if you trigger the effect that goes into like over elemental, you know, overdrive mode, I'm going to call it. Well, now you fire two lasers from the spell, which makes it pretty freaking nice if you're a big fan of that spell, which I am. And that becomes a large part of what makes you decide on how you want to tool out your kit. What spells do you want to take into any given area? Another element that might factor into this is the fact that in addition to the traditional tears, where like you might fight mid bosses or end stage bosses, there are also other tears that can sometimes be displayed or hidden within levels or just in plain sight, depending on the circumstances. Sometimes you have to make them appear by defeating all enemies on the screen or just get to a special area within the level. These tears have monster gauntlets, and you have a limited amount of time to which to win. I don't know what happens if you let that run out, and honestly, you might not have a finite amount of time, but the reason why I'll never know that is because the game is still technically timing you, and the faster you beat them, the better your rank is for clearing enemies in that tear. And if you manage to get an A rank on a tear clear, you'll get a bonus item element. It might be an item that increases your attack damage, or it might be an item that allows you to do buy certain things at the store in the library. There's a number of things you can win, and ultimately you're going to want to win all of them. So if you see a B ranking, just prepare to do it all over again, because you're not going to settle for a B in this game, because Bs mean nothing and As mean everything. Because A, everything starts with the letter A now. I'm changing it. So at any given point in time, you're free to leave the book, or by more, let me phrase that. As you're exploring a level, you'll come across couches, and couches can be sat on to relax and rest your character. In these situations, you are able to save your game. You could also use this at any time to get counseling from one of the characters, one of the NPCs in the game called Davina. And you can also use it to return to the library proper. When you go back to the library, you are able to talk to other NPCs there and learn more about the game world itself. There are books you can read there. And there's also a shop where you can go to spend items that you've acquired to either A, improve and enhance the magic you've got. Like, you might, for example, want to learn a spell in one of the books, more of which will be unlocked as you play through the game. You spend currency on that. You can spend currency to advance the spell to make it stronger, or to unlock one of its side properties or additional properties to make it behave in a different way. You might have a spell that drops balls from the sky at a 45-degree angle, but now you can drop more balls at a 45-degree angle, or it might widen the arc of a spin attack, things like that. All of which are absolutely worth buying and unlocking. You can also spend resources to earn items that you can equip on your character using 5 slots, of which each of the items you can equip, magic items they're called, take up a certain number of bits on a, it's like an equipment bar, like a charm might take 2 bits out of 4. And if you equip it, you lose half of the available equip capacity you've had available to start with. Of course, as you play through the game and also do well on those tears, like I mentioned before, you'll gain the ability to earn more slots there, which will allow you to equip more items of stronger properties. So it kind of incentivizes you to kick butt, take names, and grow your character even further. And that's on top of the traditional level of system the game has. I love the game in the sense that I enjoy doing various combo attacks, getting the right set of spells equipped, and then kind of cycling them in a mad frenzy. Though being an old-ass man, every once in a while I could also find myself feeling slightly overwhelmed on like the stuff I got going on. Like, okay, am I set up with the right equipment or equipment items while I'm dodging boss attacks or whatever? Am I doing this properly? But at the end of the day, it doesn't stop me from enjoying the game. I do play it on hard mode because of course I freaking do. And there's a lot of fun to be had in customizing your attack kit with the right spells and doing exceptionally well against an enemy that would have otherwise given you problems. I feel like the only real gripe I have about this game is the fact that the enemy variety isn't as good as I would like it to be, which, coming from a compile heart game, that says a lot, because they're very hit and miss. Some people love them, some people hate them, and some people are just kind of fed up with them. I'm in the camp that I've always liked them, but I've also had my moments where I felt less compelled to play them at different times because I've kind of felt like I've fallen out of them. But this game kind of changed that for me a little bit. I want to play this game. I enjoy playing this game. And I do believe this is a step up from recent Compile Heart games. And I forgot to even mention the fact that it even has light Metroidvania elements to it, because as you explore the books...
Oh, look at you saying the M word.
Yeah, Compile Heart did something for me today. They deserve it. So, well, I'm not going to go so far to say this is like an intricately woven map with tight corridors and passageways and secrets. I will say there are elements of these levels that you can't always access from the very beginning. But as you progress through the books, you will learn and gain different special abilities. You know, the traditional fare, ground pounds and air dashes and double jumps. You know what I'm talking about. But as you get them, you can go back to previous books that you've already cleared, or not, if you decide to leave them early, which I did. I went, got an ability, left the book, got an ability, left the book, and then eventually I just had a bunch of abilities and just like tried to clear the books fully. But you can go back and get items you couldn't have gotten before. Perfectly reasonable, perfectly fun. But all in all, I think they did a great job with this game. It's a beautiful game. The voice work is solid. The music is good. There's no rock going on here, but it's a very easy listening soundtrack with the occasional climactic crescendos for the right battles. I think this is good and an absolute surprise. I was not expecting a game like this to come out at this time of the year in this part of the country from this company, localized entirely on my PlayStation 5. And yet here we are. So, and I think you should play it? I'm not going to be a Seymour Skinner. I think you should play it. I think it'll be worth it to you.
All right. Well, it's a $30 game. What do you think of that?
I think it's a solid buy it recommendation. You, even if you feel like you're typically not a fan of Compile Heart Fair, I think it's worth giving this game a shot. It might surprise you.
Very good. All right, moving on. We've got No Skin. Oh, God, that's scary. Developed by No Eye Soft. What is No Skin or Eyes? What the hell? Published by Feardemic.
Brooklyn.
Release March 19th is an Xbox Play Anywhere title, Switch, PS4, and PS5 for $6.99. Face the horrors lurking around the horse. The horse.
Lurking around the horse, of course. And when you want to lurk with horses. Go. Sorry.
It's just like the idea of a horror game centered around just a barn with a single horse chasing you. Anyway, face the horrors lurking around the house and discover who the no-skin man truly is. What started as a normal night with your friends quickly turned into something far more twisted. Fight, talk, trade, and pray for one more turn as you delve deeper into each room, trying to survive this madness. Horror Acolyte, tell us about No Skin.
Okay, No Skin is a horror roguelite. Slight asterisk on the roguelite portion, but we'll circle back to that a bit later. You play as a character named Noir. After working a 14-hour shift, she goes out drinking with some of her friends. She seems to have had too much to drink and passes out for a bit, but upon returning to the world of the waking, she decides to procure more alcohol and runs into him. This bloody, meaty-looking individual named Super Meat Boy. No, actually, that's not right.
crossover.
No, Noir has the displeasure of encountering the no-skin man in a dark hallway, all the flesh having been removed from his body, asking, "Where is my skin?" She says she doesn't know where it is, but he insists that she does. Until she gives him back his skin, she'll be cursed to see things as they truly are. He gives Noir some items to get her started, but warns if he sees her again and she doesn't have his skin, he'll be the last thing she ever sees. The game starts out with this kind of intro segment. You do a combat tutorial against this training dummy called Pathetic Dummy. Shows off the combat setup for the game, which has a pretty basic setup reminiscent of what you would see in an old school kind of dungeon crawler. So this kind of flat pixelated enemy character model on the screen with its kind of name above it and heart pieces above them. You have your own health pool off to the side and two currency amounts above your health pool. On your turn, you can attack, pray, use any number of items in your inventory, or try to escape a fight. Attacking or praying will immediately end your turn. Praying allows you to reduce all incoming damage from a single attack to one, which is useful when an enemy telegraphs they're going to be charging up for a powerful attack. You start out with a knife, gun, and some ammo. For each weapon, it shows you the accuracy of that weapon and the amount of damage it deals, as well as how much ammo is left for it, with physical weapons being usable indefinitely. At the start of a run, this bar appears on your screen that says percentage obtained in order to find skin, and it starts out at 2. This bar also has these little skull markers on it indicating boss fights once you reach a certain percentage point. You'll visit a series of locations. After visiting a location, a bar will go up by 2 points. When choosing between them, you have 3 locations to choose between. Each location has 3 to 4 different events that can take place at it. These are listed below each location with the probability of each event occurring, with at least one such event being combat, usually having the highest probability out of all the possible events. The same areas can also reappear multiple times in future selections, so you can say that you'll see the same ones appear multiple times in the same area. Other events, including finding items on the ground, like you'll find blood and bile, which will give you a temporary boost in health points, or cigarettes, which will help increase your chances of escaping a fight for some reason. encountering NPCs like the long-filled fish, who will sell you an assortment of goods, or these crimson dancers who will bestow upon you blessings like being able to heal after every fight or upgrading your weapon effectiveness. You might find a goat you can sacrifice to gain temporary health, a skeleton man who plays Russian roulette with you to give you some additional currency, or maybe you just want to take a nice shower in a bathroom and regain some health. a lot of the enemies you encounter in the game will be your friends that you were drinking with. Apparently, they were all harboring some deep-seated resentment towards you because they're out for blood. Like your friend Nadine, who is now wearing a blindfold with blood dripping below her eyes, fashioning a nice poison shiv. This is a good time to mention there are a handful of status effects in the game, like poison, that acts as a general damage over time effect, but lasts a set number of turns, and can carry over in between fights. Or bleed, which makes you take on additional damage from all sources. You also fight other enemies, like blood-crazed cultists and two-headed hellhounds. Killing enemies yields crimson and lunar fragments, along with various utility items. Crimson fragments can be used to buy items and services from characters, like better weapons, healing, power-ups, all usable for the current run you're on. Lunar fragments are usable before a run and are permanent unlock. Before a run and are used to get permanent unlocks that carry over for all future runs. These include access to new rooms or enemies, new items from vendors, and potentially a free blessing at the start of the run. Once you explore more, the meter fills up and your memories become more vivid, increasing your health and giving you access to more rooms. The no-skin man's curse also intensifies, increasing the enemy's health points for all enemies. As I previously mentioned, reaching certain percentages triggers boss fights. So after beating the first boss, you gain the ability to talk to enemies during encounters. Some engage in casual banter or mainly talk about their desire to see you dead. Others offer insider clues to deal with other enemies or to help solve larger mysteries presented within the game. Beating the second boss allows you to trade with enemies during battle, which you can trade for fragments, health, or other items at random, or mostly random, I should say. As this curse meter intensifies, things become more and more deranged. The locations you visit, which start out as normal rooms like the garden, the basement, bedrooms, or like the attic, change into places like the Sea of Blood, a single eye, or the Blade, the Fingers, and Roses. Yeah, it's pretty messed up stuff. The visuals for your friends also become more unsettling. They start out somewhere mildly timid. Esther has like a bloodied face, then her name changes to Esther the Throat Cutter, and she has these little bloodied flesh sacks floating above her head.
Oh, cute.
They're very cute. Very cute. So yeah, all your friends get more deranged like that as you progress through the locations. Once you complete a run, you increase your faith level, which allows you to increase the difficulty of the game. At level 2, you get less currency earned from killing enemies. You have a lower chance to escape. Level 3, for example, you get less health overall, and this keeps going up. I'm not sure where it maxes out. And then once you go up, you also retain all the previous modifiers, so everything stacks together. So this is where the game gets interesting. So what I've described up until this point is kind of the general setup for a roguelite game. But in actuality, the roguelite format is used as a baseline to help in what I would essentially call puzzle solving, with the main goal of this game being working out, essentially needing to find the information to get the true ending for the most part, or like a series of different, like, quote unquote, like true endings. I don't know if there's like a pure final one. I haven't got them all myself yet, but there's multiple kind of like endings or mysteries to resolve, I guess. I don't want to spoil too much story-wise. But yeah, everything you do in these runs is, or at least try to do, is like find more information to solve, to help you learn more for the next run, or to reach the end point of one of the mysteries, essentially. So I would say so far, being able to find the information has been pretty accessible, and so has like being able to beat the game. Like I almost cleared the like first run on my first try, like through the game, which wasn't that difficult. I don't know if I got lucky, but yeah, but at the same time, it's such a strange game that I feel like there could be a ton of stuff I've overlooked because there's like a lot of cryptic symbols and like, I don't know if they're just, you know, there to be cryptic and like look, make the game seem stranger, if they're like purposeful. So there's still stuff I need to figure out. I know I've got two achievements left, but after you've completed a run, you also unlock an alternate mode called the Dream Diary, which has a short lore-based scenarios that you can use to unlock stuff for the main game. And these, yeah, will provide insight into, like, some more of the characters and, like, I guess a bit more about the relationship with the main character, among other things. You also get the ability to unlock additional characters who have slightly different starting inventory, weapons, and health points. And they also help you uncover different story elements throughout their run. And their goals may not be quite the same as Noir's, your starting character. And yeah, when it comes to this one, I love the visual style, the atmosphere, the character models, especially with the evolution of their derangement, are well suited to the gameplay format. The soundtrack strikes a good balance between being unsettling and brooding, while also making you feel like there's this glimmer of hope and kind of wonder. The roguelite structure is basic, and personally I feel like it didn't offer an abundance in the way of variety. That being said, it's still enjoyable, especially for the earlier hours of the game, and it's fairly well put together. The most contentious part of this game is going to be how much someone wants to keep playing through the runs in order to solve all the mysteries or get like a true ending or some type of finality to it. Just based on how repetitive it gets. But it's an awkward balance to strike. Like I would say No Skin is very efficiently made, since there's just enough there to keep it interesting as a roguelike game, and not too much so that it becomes cumbersome if you want to play through and try to solve everything. But it kind of does that at the sacrifice of losing like the variety of like what would make a good roguelite seem more fresh each time. So there's a trade off there, but I think it is well designed to be efficient for the puzzle solving aspect of it. So,
all right,
take for that what you will.
The game clocks in at $6.99. So for $7, is No Skin a no brainer or a no no?
You son of a bitch! That was gonna be my thing. I was gonna say No Skin is for $6 is a no brainer. Yeah.
Really? Hell yeah!
I wrote that down.
Fuck yeah!
Neither of you are funny. Quit.
Go to hell, Aki.
Puns.
I laugh.
This game is gonna make like my short list for like when I write my top 10 games of the year list. It'll probably be on the short list for that. Yeah, it's I don't want to like oversell it, because like the puzzle aspect isn't so amazing that it's like brilliant, but it's like interesting enough that it like is a fresh take on like a roguelite formula that I enjoy. I haven't played anything quite like it myself, so
very good.
But yeah, it's good. Play it.
All right, moving on. Next up, Ink Inside, developed by Blackfield Entertainment, published by Intalto Publishing. It released March 27th on Steam for $9.99. Ink Inside is a cozy and chaotic, isn't that kind of like an oxymoron right there, cozy and chaotic, whatever, story-driven action RPG from X-Cartoon Network and Horror Devs, a unique indie cartoon aesthetic adventure with heart, beat-em-up, and ball combat, laughably weird items, crazy deep lore, live-action cutscenes, human-orchestrated soundtrack, handmade assets, and full VO. Purnell, what is Ink Inside?
Interesting that it was made in part by former Cartoon Network people. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So,
you learned
something. Well, here we go. Let's talk shop about the former Cartoon Network spokes game. So, in the game Ink Inside, you play as a character known as Stick, and he exists in a world of books. This world of books is essentially a box of sketches and art pieces that were drawn by a little girl by the name of Hannah. Hannah is a little girl in our world, the real world, who throughout her life has drawn and doodled and sketched things, whether it was influenced by events in her life or people she met or whatever. and this came together to create this world. And all the inhabitants of this world are parts of that. Now, the game takes place over a series of like live action sequences where you see events that take place in the real world and also the world you're playing in, which is the book world. It is here that the stick is running around and interacting with other characters. And the real crux of it is that, unlike the other characters in this world, Stick is referred to as an unfinished. He does not remember who he is. He has no memories, whereas everyone else has memories associated with why Hannah created them and why they exist. And he was awakened by an individual by the name of Detective Fuzz because he found him lying out in the world, out in the wild. And as a result, Stick is on a journey to try to figure out who he is. And he has bits of visions of being a hero, so he wants to act upon those visions as well. It's kind of cool how they do the interspersing between the live action sequences and the book segments, because the way that they create this world and the way they give it its predicament is directly tied back to the real world. So Stick becomes a hero by way of the fact that this world is being plagued by something called the Sog. The Sog, at its core, is a leak from the roof that is dripping into the box of books that is in a closet that was placed there by Anna. So unfortunately, over time, the drippings hit the pages. The pages get wet, and characters in this world that get hit by the water become soggy, aggressive, angry creatures who are a danger to everyone. And it also corrupts the world itself. And as you're exploring the world, you may occasionally have to engage with fighting these characters. And for reasons associated with the lore of the game itself that gets told as you play, the fare of combat in this game is dodgeball. Everyone knows about it. Everyone does it. It's not just a weird mechanic they slapped in here. It's well known and established. So when you get into a scuffle with enemies, you will be on one side of the screen, you and occasionally a companion when you meet companions, and the enemies will be on another. You start out with the ability to throw balls, but in this game they're referred to as cores. Balls that, when connected with enemies, have the ability to fill them with ink. Don't ask about the logistics, just know you're hitting them with a dodgeball. And that's it. But this is the cure, the way to heal sogged creatures of their soggy plight. So in combat, as you're running around, you will hold down the trigger button and then use the right thumbstick to aim, and then eventually launch your attack. Or not right thumbstick, just like your thumbstick in general. And you will launch the attack. So at that point, once you've done that, you will hopefully connect with the enemy. And if you do, you'll do damage and the ball will come back to you. If you happen to miss, the ball will end up being knocked to the ground, and it will have a period at which it needs to recharge itself before you can pick it up and rethrow it again. So that becomes a predicament if you have a bit of bad aim. Watch yourself on that front. Each of these cores also, over time, can eventually have special abilities, which, once you've done enough damage with them, you can hit the Y button to trigger that special ability and get a little bit extra oomph out of it. Stick is also a particularly special character. I'm not going to go into all the different battle mechanics. There's a surprising number of them, but the most noted one, due to the nature of the character, is that he also has a special property that no one else in this world has. And that is the ability to break the rules. Breaking the rules being that he can cross the dodgeball line and punch people, something that no one else can do. So once you charge your special meter to its maximum level, that is to say you decide not to use your special abilities, instead just want to go forward and do this, you can trigger this effect, punch through they call it the invisible wall, and just start wailing on enemies. You can do melee attacks. You can do like launcher attacks and slam attacks and the works that put the extra bit of hurt on them. But you have to get back to the other side before your timer runs out. I think if it runs out on you, you get kicked back over with a slight penalty. But ultimately, you just want to be back on this side of the line before the power runs out. So there are a number of different combat elements that unlock as you play through the game that make combat a bit more complicated. But for the most part, that is what you're dealing with. And for the most part, it's a pretty engaging combat system. It can get a little bit chaotic from time to time. Unfortunately, for better or worse, I was playing on the Steam Deck, and I would have slowdown here and there from it, which surprises me because this isn't a particularly intensive, resource-intensive game visually anyway. But
it is listed as verified too, so that is curious.
Yeah, it could have just been might be some patchwork required or something. But yeah, I would have occasional moments of slowdown, most notably in like combat segments where there's a lot of like objects on the screen, and you know I'm still going crazy with it.
But here's a question. I'm looking at the Steam page, and one of the character says they are the princess of cursing. How did Aki get in this game?
Aki wishes she was the princess of cursing, because, oh, God, this character is awesome. I kid. Aki's awesome, too. But yeah, honestly, she's a pretty cool character. She's legitimately the princess of cursing, and she swears multiple times in her sentences. And the thing that makes it particularly nice is certain TV shows and games will bleep out dialogue when it's either vulgar or not. And a lot of times you'll find yourself going, that's kind of grown worthy. I'm an adult. I can handle this. But this is one of those nice occasions where the bleeping actually makes it better. Like sometimes you'll get this bleep at a string of statements. You're like, what can she be possibly say that's getting bleeped out there? It doesn't even make sense. And yet it's getting bleeped out. It's freaking great. And you would think she'd be quite the jerk of a character because initially the introducer just like, she curses all the time and she seems like she's angry all the time. But she's actually a very nice character once you get to know her. She just also happens to be based around the fact that Hannah had a thing for cursing at one point and wanted to make a character specifically devoted to swearing. It's glorious. I do feel like also that you can equip certain items too. You can equip dodgeballs, 2 dodgeballs per character. And those dodgeballs will pretty much be littered throughout the battle as you play. You'll cycle through them too. So if you want to have one particular type of ball over another, you might just want to put 2 of them on, and you'll just have 2 of that type of ball coming out. Or you can have 2 different ones, and then it's available when you need it, and you can just throw it and use it and put it to good use. There's a job system in this game, though. It's not the same kind of jobs as you'd expect, but it's still pretty cool in that you can equip a job, and it will give you a series of goals that you have to meet. And if you meet enough of the goal or all the goals, you'll unlock the perk of that job. It might be something like doing additional damage with ranged attacks or area attacks, things like that. So it's just it upgrades your play style in a way that will let you lean in harder on the way you want to play the game. There's a lot of charm in this bad boy, to be perfectly honest with you. I do feel as though there is a lot to love here, but there is a little bit of, jankiness along the edges sometimes. So like I mentioned, the aforementioned slowdowns when I wasn't expecting them to happen. There was the moment here and there where I didn't really quite pick up on why a transition happened. I just assumed that it was them trying to interact with Stick having a grainy memory reset. But it was like, okay, flip me through the page. Now I'm in this place. Why am I in this place? I have no freaking idea. But now I'm back out of the place and I'm back where I thought I should be. He must have been dreaming. Okay, I'll deal with that. But it seemed kind of abrupt and it annoyed me. Also, sometimes in combat, they can get a little bit on the extra crazy side, and you might find yourself feeling a little lost in the shuffle, but chances are you might also get advanced enough with the game where it won't be a bother to you. It drove me crazy sometimes, though. And to be fair, they do give you ways to heal your character, too. Like, for example, the healing in this game primarily involves you stopping in the middle of the field. As long as you've charged up some of your super gauge in previous battles, you can burn that gauge energy to heal yourself. And there's also items you can equip where you can put them on the ground in combat and they'll be like an area of effect healing a circle for you. So there are ways to keep yourself healed. You can take vending machines, but locate vending machines throughout the world and combine items that you've already acquired to unlock new, more improved items. Like, for example, you might have a shoe that allows you to dash. But if you combine that dashing shoe with the Walkman, which provides the healing effect at the vending machine that allows you to do so, you'll get healing dashing shoes. So you'll use resources you've acquired throughout the game and then discard them in order to get better versions of one, the other, or something completely new and entirely different. It just depends. But that is also means to say that you will get multiples of items. So get ready for being able to scroll through a lot of different of the same item on your inventory screen from time to time. I think a large thing that mainly carries this game beyond the fact that, it looks nice and all, is the characters themselves. Because, like, the dodgeball element, I won't lie, I've done a little bit better with this, but not everything's going to be Dodgeball Academia with its Dragon Ball Z antics. But with that said, the dodgeball in this game is both fun and serviceable. And unlike Dodgeball Academia, this game has that very charming aspect of combining a children's play world with real world scenarios and elements that kind of draw you into like what it means to like grow up and what, you know, basically the crafting of your memories and what they mean to you as an adult and things like that. It's a great game. I feel like I'm rambling a bit, but I want to convey the fact that while this game is not perfect by any means, I do feel as though it is a good time and it is worthy of people giving it a chance if they like the element of like hand-drawn characters and what I consider to be a fairly imaginative narrative too.
All right. Well, let's talk price on this one. It clocks in at $9.99. If you pick it up before April 9th, you could get it for $6.49. That is a crazy launch discount. $10. What do you think?
I think it's a solid try. And I think if you do decide to give it a try, it's more likely to fit into your wheelhouse than not.
Very good. All right. Any other thoughts on it?
I feel all inked inside. I just wanted to say that for some reason because Aki hates puns.
She does. Next up is a pun title. Hosey, developed by Come On Studio, published by Tiny Build. Released March 30th on Steam for $14.99. Restore forgotten neighborhood through your favorite hobby, one cozy room at a time. In Hosey, clean, paint, and decorate abandoned homes with satisfying mechanics and intuitive controls. Enjoy the little details as you interact with tools, items, and furniture to bring each space back to life. Aki, tell us about Hosey.
Okay, in this, you are playing as someone. It doesn't really express who, but you go around fixing up people's houses, more or less. You know, you empty them of all their trash, do any small repairs that are necessary, and then you get a shit ton of boxes, and you pop them open, you start placing stuff around to make it a home instead of just an empty set of rooms. There are 9 levels in this, each one being a place that you renovated. Most of them aren't. It's not like you're going in and being like, okay, this is the kitchen. Let's put kitchen stuff here. Oh, this is bedroom. Let's put the bedroom stuff. No, it's you walk in and it's just a room and you decorate it with everything that's there. A lot of times you're picking up trash, tossing it away, and it's all like, oh, click on the trash and it starts sucking it up to you, and you can only hold so much before you have to drop it over into the trash can. Otherwise, it'll just start falling as you're moving around. Sometimes you'll have to sweep up stuff. Typically, it's leaves. You'll have to clean the floors, walls, windows, all that fun stuff. Sometimes you're expected to paint. Sometimes you're expected to rip up flooring and replace it, so on and so forth. But the real part of this is after that's done, all the boxes, they're all labeled for the most part of generally what they are, like, not like, oh, this is chairs, this is tables, but it's like huge objects, lights, wall, stuff like that. So, you know, stuff that's in the box that says wall goes on the, would anyone like to take a guess?
The fridge.
No,
damn,
go back to kindergarten. Sorry, it goes on the wall. And large objects are fuck off sized objects. You know, it is what it is. It's very simple. Thankfully, you don't know how many objects are in any of these boxes. There's just an amount in it, and you get out. It's not like you have to put any of it together. It's just there, and you find a spot for it. You can angle it however you want with the mouse. On the controller, I wasn't able to figure out how to do it as well because it's not anywhere near as fine-tuned to angle individual objects. Most of the rest of the game works really well with the controller, just not angling objects. That's terrible with the controller. Instead, it seems to have preset areas that you can move it around, and those don't always line up with, like, walls and stuff. So as someone who's very anal retentive about that, not very useful. And yeah, so you're doing this. Each house is its own thing. You occasionally find some word bubbles above specific items. You click on them, and the character talks about whoever you're doing this for a little bit. It's not a ton of stuff. Usually it's like three-ish bubbles that you'll find that just gives you a little more backstory between your character and whoever you're doing this for. And yeah, it's a pretty short game. Takes a few hours to beat. There's not really much in the way of any sort of story. It's just a chillax little thing. You sit back and you just waste a couple hours just enjoying yourself with something simple.
Nice. Sounds sounds relaxing.
It is, very. That's why it's hosy. It's a house that's cozy.
Well, it's $15. What do you think?
I'm totally for it. I think it's cute. I think it's would be better if you got it on like sale, because again, it's 9 levels. Maybe 3-4 hours, something like that.
Yeah. Well, it is on sale until the 6th for $13.49. What do you think of that?
That's a lot better. But yeah, I think it's worth buying, though. I think it's a cute little game. If you like these, you know, little chill games where you're just kind of mindlessly doing stuff, this is definitely for you.
All right. Next up, from one weird house to another, Living Dead House. Developed by Deprecated Games, published by Flynn's Arcade. Released April 2nd on the Switch for $4.99. Living Dead House delivers a pulse-pounding classic arcade experience. Battle through waves of the undead solo or team up with a friend. Survive the night, escape the dead, darkness descends, and the undead rise. Purnell, what is going on in Living Dead House?
Living Dead how? Well, science, of course. So in this game, you play as individuals. I'm pretty sure they're inspired by the Night of the Living Dead movies, the earlier ones specifically. And you don't get to choose one per se, but I'm guessing in two players, you get to get, there's like two different characters. But in this game, it think of it as like a Pac-Man style game, or not Pac-Man style, but like a single screen arcade style game where you are tasked with surviving for a period of time in a level space replicate or resemble a form of a house from the undead. As you start the game out, you will be in a room with a number of different staircases, various gimmick objects like elevators and frontal, like, you know, raising and lowering platforms and the like, and enemies in the form of zombies will be trying to break into this space. There are windows, there are doors, and eventually one of these two things will get smashed open. And when that happens, zombies will come pouring into the house one at a time. As you're running around the level, you'll come across objects like bear traps and guns and flamethrowers, all of which have single uses, and you can apply them to kill enemies. You can also come across floor, you know, nails and or hammer and boards to board up the things that they've broken through in order to prevent them from getting in through that entrance for a period of time. You'll come across items that can spell secret words to give you bonuses if you can pull that off. And then for the most part, it's running against time to try to score as many points as possible by killing zombies and collecting items and surviving the night until the day wraps up. Every once in a while, a level might even have like a Pac-Man style, like wrap around where you can go out one side of the level and come in from the other, which is kind of cool. Overall, it's not a very complicated game by any means. But what is worth noting is that it's actually pretty freaking fun. Wasn't expecting it to be that fun in that sense, but I was getting the one more go itch. I wanted to see if I could survive and get a little bit further. And it helps that it does have elements of, you know, like a little bit of chaos that makes every run feel a little different, despite the fact that the levels themselves are the same as you go from stage to stage, as in stage 1-2 will always be stage 1-2. What I mean by that, for example, is you don't know what items are going to spawn when or where on a stage. In addition to that, some of the zombies have weird effects that you can't time, for example, or you can't predict. For example, you might kill a zombie, and traditionally he'll just blow up and die. Other times, though, his head might fall off and hit the ground and start rolling across the floor. but the head's still biting. And if you touch the head before it just kind of falls over and dies, you'll still get killed by the rolling head. Other times, the legs will be left over, and they'll start jumping around. And if the jumping legs get you, you will die. So you can't just kill and run. You have to kill, but also be mindful of knowing sometimes the kill is not the kill. In addition to that, one of the traps that always screws me up is the bear trap. It's a really good item that you can pick up, and when you put it on the ground, if zombies walk over it, they'll get, you know, eviscerated by the bear trap, and it works over multiple bites before it eventually breaks. However, it also works on you. So if you're not paying attention, you walk over your own bear trap, it will kill you. Something to be mindful of. That's how they get you. It's like, nope, just because you think you're great doesn't mean you are. Be smart about what you place and where you place it. But it's not a lot to ramble about here. The game is pretty straightforward. There's an arcade mode where you run from state to state. There's also a survival mode where you're just playing as long as you can before you get overwhelmed and killed by zombies. But all in all, it's a great game and one that I can wholeheartedly recommend. Not I don't even know what the quality is. Like, but I hope it was fun. Easy buy recommendation.
Easy buy. All right, one final game tonight. We have a quick preview of Descent of Lunaris, developed by Unison Games, developed and published by Unison Games. Releasing later this year on Steam, investigate a signal emanating from deep within the moon and fight through a dark reflection of human nature. Are you being tested or pushed for the actions of humanity or punished for the actions of humanity? Descent of Lunaris is a classic dungeon crawling turn-based RPG inspired by Wizardry and the SMT series. Purnell, give us a quick rundown of what is going on in the demo of Descent of Lunaris.
So Descent of Lunaris is a pretty cool dungeon crawling game. And I also think I previewed the not even official build back in the day. So this may not be too different from that, except to say there are no placeholder graphics anymore. Everything's populated, which is freaking nice. And there's also a prologue that plays out as well to kind of get you, set you into the mood of the overall world you're playing in. But basically, you're on the moon, a moon base to be specific, and you are exploring this bad boy. A wizard on the moon. That would be nice. Hey, that's futuristic.
It's an old Destiny reference. I don't know if anyone gets that anymore.
My problem is I never got into Destiny because I was like, I can't do this, but I like the intro to Destiny, and I'll take it. But you're exploring this moon base for a variety of different reasons. Again, this is a preview, not the review. But the thing that makes it particularly interesting is that it does carry a lot of the same, like, you know, typical wizardry, dungeon crawl, Etrianasi-esque, you know, quirks, as in you have to craft a party that's composed of various, you know, party member or class types, archetypes. Though, one thing that's cool about them in this game is that even though once you've made your party of four characters, which come in a number of things, like, you know, a swordsman, defender type character, there's like a nanomancer, which I thought was a pretty cool class. But once you choose your four characters and you want to create the order in which they exist in, there is a front line, a back line, and you choose which area you want the character to go into. Some perform better than others, and perform better in one or the other, depending on their class. But in addition to that, depending on who you choose to put in the lead of your party, that will trigger a team-based leader effect that will work throughout the entire party. You might put a character in the lead, and as a result, every character heals for 10% additional hit points at the end of a combat. Or you might have additional evasion stats, things like that. So it'll make you actually care about who's the lead in the party, not just who looks cooler. As you're running around the map, you'll explore, come across various objects that you can acquire to potentially heal your character or equip to, you know, give yourself better attack or defense stats. Traditional fare there. Visually, the game looks really nice. Musically, the game does a great job of basically showing off that which it says it's influenced by, because I definitely get the moody tones that I would get from, like, Shin Megami Tensei Strange Journey, for example. Not the... but the somber, I don't feel like I'm in a very safe place type of music. It's good stuff. But I think the thing that really makes this game special, and now actually before I even say that, but I want to turn into how the attacks work too. Special attacks in this game use an AP system, just like MP or SP or whatever. But almost all the specials in this game have cooldowns. So this is designed so that you can't spam your best attack so long as you have the AP to do it. Instead, you have to be smart about it. You have to be mindful of the fact that you can't always just use your group heal effect. And sometimes you got to have items on standby, or if you really feel like you're doing that poorly, maybe have two characters that can heal so you can kind of rotate as needed while the cooldowns are working through each other. You'll be able to level up your character skills by earning skill points as you defeat enemies and get experience points to level up your character. But again, those things are all pretty straightforward. But now to go back to the thing I kind of jumped off of and now I want to come back to is the fact that this game actually does something interesting in that it does both turn-based combat, as in, again, traditional Etrian Odyssey, Wizardry, Shin Megami Tensei type fare, but it also has tactical battles too, a la Shin Megami Tensei Devil Survivor, or, I don't know, Final Fantasy Tactics without the job. I guess, hey, what do you have the job system? That's it. But yeah, like Final Fantasy Tactics or whatever, where you have to be concerned about your character placement on the map in addition to enemy placement. And all the attacks that you've earned or that you've been using in combat now have new properties that are associated with the tactical combat fare. For example, an attack that might let you hit an entire row of enemies in the traditional turn-based battle will say everybody in the front row or everybody in the back row. But when you're in a tactical system battle, it might actually instead be three spaces in front of you or two spaces in front of you, as opposed to a straight line and all that kind of stuff. So your attacks will function differently and require you to change your way of performing or engaging combat when the tactical fare actually opens up. And it does mess with you a little bit, and not in a bad way. It just makes you go, oh, crap, I wasn't ready for a tactical battle. Shit. Now I got to work my way through this mess here. Like, you're not used to playing a game that has both at the same time. And I think that's a strong suit to this game. And again, the only other game I think I've ever played that did something even similar to that was probably Shin Megami Tensei Devil Survivor. But that wasn't even this. I think I look forward to this game coming out when it hits its final build. I really look forward to seeing what becomes of it, because this was a demo, and I didn't go hard on it only because I knew it was a demo. I want to play the actual game now.
By the way, the public demo went live March 9th, so I'm guessing whatever you checked out earlier was just like a private early build or a preview build.
Well, I can definitely recommend to anybody who sees it on the store and is like, should I try this? Yeah, you absolutely should try the demo. But also, if you're like me, you might also just watch the video reel and be like, well, I got other games to play right now, but I know I'm buying this when it comes out. So,
you have other stuff to play now because it's not out now. We don't know when it's out. It's supposed to be out sometime later this year. The demo is free to grab on Steam. Is this something people should follow, wishlist, ignore? What should people do with the Scent of Lunaris?
Absolutely wishlist this game. I think it's going to be a fantastic title when it hits the ground and is able to run on its own two legs, or four legs, depending on the creature. But I think this has something special going on. It may have that secret sauce. And I really hope that's proven right when the game releases, because I can tell you one thing, I look forward to playing the final build. So,
very good.
At least wishlist it.
All right. And with that, we are done with this episode. Big thanks to Andrew Smith coming on in the first half of the show, chatting about Trash Goblin with me, Aki, and Bree. Big thanks to Tim for coming on, hanging out in the second half of the show, chatting about Super Meat Boy. And then big thanks to you three for being here the whole time and hanging out.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
Music. This episode, since we had goblins earlier, we're going to keep the theme going with some more ghosts and goblins, this time from our buddies at Viking Guitar Live.
No, I miss Viking Guitar.
I can't keep bananas.
Indeed. Does anyone have any final words to wrap up this episode?
Give me back my skin.
Perfect.